screwed up. Play it, he ended up going to a local office and working there for 3 months.
At least it did. At least they didn't have to commute.
Okay, recording.
Okay, thank you very much. And it's 5:30 according to my watch. So, I'd like to call the meeting of the Carson City Advisory Board to Manage Wildlife to order. Call to order, and tomorrow, a determination of quorum, please.
Chairperson Martin. Vice Chairperson Zucker.
Here.
Member Powell.
Here.
Member Valley.
Here.
Member Yannick.
Here.
The quorum is present.
Thank you very much. At this time, I'd like to take public comment. The public is invited at this time to comment on and discuss any topic that is relevant to or within the authority of the Carson City Advisory Board to Manage Wildlife. Seeing none, I'd like to move to item number 3, election of a chair and vice chair. The bylaws of the city require that the first meeting of the year that an election be held in this regard. The rules, I just reviewed them, are that no sitting chair can serve for more than 2 consecutive terms starting last year after they adopted their new bylaws. I've just completed my first year, so if I was reelected, I could not serve after this year. And the same would be true of the vice chair, Mr. Vice Chair. Oh, the vice chair isn't subject to that rule?
He can be elected as many times as he wants.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, good.
Good news.
So with that as a background, I would like to open for nomination to the board members, members for chair and vice chair.
Okay, at the point of information, Mr. Chairman, does the chair want to do another term? I guess that's the first question we need to ask.
Well, if elected, I will serve. If appointed.
I would like to nominate Doug Martin for chair and Stan for vice chair, if possible. I think you guys did a good job this year. And at the time of this new retirement appointment you have, you might have a little more time. But I thought it was well done, so I'm okay with that.
I'll start with that.
Can we do one position?
You bet. So I'd like to nominate Doug Martin as chair and Stan Zuber as vice chair.
It's hard to
listen.
To listen.
Yeah, I know.
Exactly. All right.
End it there.
So I'll second that.
Any other nominations?
I'd like to nominate Stan Zuber for chair.
I'll second.
Any other nominations among the board? Tamar, you okay then? You got what you would like?
Then we vote for one and then the second.
Right, we'll do chair first and then we'll do vice chair second. Any discussion? Seeing none, I'd like to call for the first nomination, reappointment of Doug Martin as chair. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 None opposed. Moving to the second nomination, I'd like to call to...
Can I get a clarification?
She's pregnant. Who said aye?
No, I... Oh. Did you nominate Stan as chair or vice chair?
Chair.
Okay, so...
Oh, you nominated him as chair? Oh, okay.
I thought you said vice chair.
I'm sorry. No,
but
you said...
So we have two nominations for chair.
We have two nominations for chair.
Okay, so the first one we voted on...
Was Doug.
Was Doug, and that was... What was the... Refresh my memory, Tamar.
Okay, so the first motion that you guys need to re-vote on now that we clarified it.
Right.
As to vote for Member Martin as chair. And then we're going to take a second vote for Member Zuber as chair.
Correct.
Well, let's back up then tomorrow. I didn't know that we had two nominees for chair. What I'd like to do is all those who would like to vote for, well, let's have a show of hands then for a vote. Number one, show of hands for Doug Martin for chair. And then I'd like to have a show of hands for Stan Zuber for chair. Thank you. Okay, there, sorry. Thank you, Tamar. That was my bad ear, I guess. Item number two then would be nominations for vice chair. I'd like to open up for nominations for vice chair.
Mr. Chairman, I'd nominate Stan Zuber for vice chair.
I'll second.
Any other nominations? I'd like to close nominations, bring it back to the board. Any discussion? Seeing none, I'd like to call for a show of hands. All those voting for Stan Zuber, please raise your hand. Thank you. Okay. Now we got that done, Tamar. Thank you. Item number four, approval of minutes from November 10th. And tomorrow, I want to thank you for getting them in the packet and getting them mailed out so we can have the time to review them. Any discussion on the minutes? Any corrections anybody see? I'd like to entertain a motion to approve, please.
I'll make the motion that we accept the minutes as submitted.
I'll second.
Any discussion? Seeing none, I'd like to call for a vote on those. All those in favor of accepting them, signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Thank you very much. Item number five, adoption of agenda. Any possible changes to the agenda that anyone sees on the board? Seeing none, I'd like to adopt the agenda. I'd like to entertain a motion, please.
So moved.
I'll second.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? Seeing none, call for a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Informational item, disclosures. I have one, but I'll save mine for last. Any other disclosures? Yes, sir.
I got contacted by Supervisor Abaud regarding our deer population in and around Carson City. I had quite a number of emails. We, you know, back and forth with her and Roger Bolendorf, Ann Bollinger, and Tony Wasley. I'm going to spend some time with Tony at the meeting in Boulder because he's been through this already. He's published a couple of papers on the subject. Whether or not they were applicable to Carson City, but I think it's something that, you know, we had that occurrence during the summer with the sheriff having to dispatch a deer because it was hit, and I don't want to, you know, debate the issue right now. I just wanted to make it the board and the public aware that she approached me, and I gave her, you know, my personal feelings. I could tell her I could not speak for the board or what the board action would be if there were any action, but I will discuss it with Tony and bring back any recommendations or suggestions that he has.
A question for you. What is, in a nutshell, the issue that Karen brought up?
She had received comments from residents regarding the proliferation of deer in and around Carson City, particularly in the downtown area around Division, Minnesota. And I talked with the sheriff's department, and there have been no deer-human interaction. You know, reported accidents where cars hit deer or deer run into people, things like that. And it's very obvious. All I have to do is look out on my lawn and I'll see 20 or 30 deer out there at a time, but I live higher up and in more remote area. But the number of deer that I've seen in the early fall and even during the summer in the city is quite apparent. I just drive slow. I see them, I wait, I watch what they do at twilight. When I drive up into Lakeview, I go very carefully around the entrance curve because I know there's always somebody lurking in the brush, and if I see one, I know there's a whole bunch behind it. So I think most of the people in the community have accepted the fact that, you know, we're right on the border of where they're home is, and they're looking for food, they're looking for water. And my personal feeling is it would take some education. I think the paper and the Department of Wildlife should get together and print some articles, you know, making people aware that it is illegal to feed the wild animal, any wild animal, I think everybody feels sorry for the animals, and they think, well, we'll give them water, we'll give them food. But it's really the worst thing that they could do to get them used to that. And especially in the wintertime when their digestive system shuts down and doesn't take in carbohydrates. So we need to tell people what's the right thing to do, my feeling. Because I think anything else that would be suggested would meet with just a tremendous outcry from the community. Whether right, wrong, I don't want to debate that issue. I just think that people who live here know about it. Most people are pretty careful. They stop, let the deer cross the street, and then they move on. I'm really looking forward to what Tony's going to suggest, because you know, talking with some of the people in the city, they're not sure what to do about it, and that's why Karen contacted me, because you know I'm in her district, and she calls me up and says, "What about this?" And I give her my two cents, and that's about it. So I bring it up here to let the board know and that people are looking for some solution. Whether there is a solution, I really don't know. If the board wants to agendize this for, you know, a later meeting, I don't know, you know, that would be fine. I don't know what we're going to do, and I think without a joint effort by the city, by the community, by the advisory board, by the Department of Wildlife, it will be the only way that we come to something that would be acceptable only after the public understands the complete situation and story as to why anything would be suggested and try to understand it.
I appreciate that, and I noticed the gentleman next to me just nodded to me in just a second, and kind of wants to chime in on this. For a point of clarification, we are in an informational item disclosure, and I think you folks walked in a little late.
And I think a good time to have discussed this would have been under public comment.
Oh, sorry.
So what I'd like to do then is, let me just say 2 cents on this, and then we'll move back to public comment. And so you can say something and don't have to sit through an entire meeting to public comment at the end. Unless you'd like to stay for the rest of this.
Thank you.
But
I haven't had dinner yet.
There you go. Well, and it's really good because a gentleman here in the corner is Mike Cox, who's actually the biologist and works in big game biology for the state of Nevada. And I'll just say that, you know, we do have a proliferation of mule deer in the urban area, urban setting now. And it's not to be unexpected, especially in times of drought. And we water our lawns, and we have food, we have water, and you're going to see more and more deer. Now, I don't know where you stand on this, but you need to understand that the advisory board, we can hear things, mm-hmm. but we can't set policy, and we can't do anything.
I don't know if there's anything that can be said.
So with that, I'd like to move back to public comment. Sir, you have a comment on deer.
Well, we've lived here 25 years. So
for the record, would you please?
Roy Farrell, my wife, Madalena. We live at 310 Mountain Street. We have neighbors on both sides that asked us to speak for them to Diarietas and Covingtons. We've lived here 25 years, and we've been through droughts, and we've been through a lot of things, but this clearly is the biggest infestation of deer. I grew up in a small town, Colorado. We knew how to take care of the problem there. In fact, we wouldn't have eaten during the winter had we not been able to take care of the problem. But that's not feasible in the civilized, close to California proximity we find ourselves. But, you know, it's impossible to keep any kind of vegetation, any flowers going. They jump all the fences, and they ran over our dog. You know, a deer tried to kill our dog. Jim, a deer had, I had one impaled on his fence that they had to come and take off his fence. I remember it's about 20 years ago, I don't know if anybody remembers or not, but we had a mountain lion kind of trotting down Mountain Street. To me, to the extent you allow this infestation to continue and proliferate, you know, we will have predators. When I first talked to Karen, she said, well, I understand they're reintroducing wolves to the Sierra, so maybe that'll solve the problem. So maybe if we have a pack of wolves come down, that might help clean out the situation. I have no idea what you can do. I know this is kind of a national phenomena, partly because people are proliferating and partly because deer don't have any really natural predators any longer. So the more and more I think communities are facing this. In North Carolina, Aaron Covington told me they opened up a bow hunting season inside the city limits to basically address the issue. Again, I think that's not feasible, particularly near the middle school. So we're very frustrated. We'd like to see something done, but we're very sympathetic because we have no clue what a solution might be. I'm a Colorado guy, so Colorado's changed a lot since I lived there, and Boulder particularly, but perhaps there's, you know, some ways to address the issue. And thank you for listening to us, and we'll leave.
Well, I appreciate that. And while you're still here, I'm just going to ask Mike. Mike, I assume this is not just a phenomenon that Carson City's this urban deer population is occurring elsewhere.
Yeah, we shouldn't feel like we're special. Mm-hmm. It happens anywhere there's mule deer habitat. Or whitetail deer habitat, and it's happening with elk.
It's happening bear. We had bear in our yard a few months ago.
Right, we've intruded into their habitat.
Well, that was 120 years ago, that you gotta remember.
That we've intruded into their habitat?
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that, but I'm a statewide big game biologist.
Mm-hmm.
Been that since 1999. I live just down the road from Gill, up in Lakeview. And the deer herds, whether it's Genoa or Carson City, Eureka, Kalliani, Spring Creek.
Do you have a solution, or are you just going to catalog where there are deer?
No.
Is there any,
no.
What you're saying is live with it, is what I hear. Is that correct?
No. Well, if you heard that, then you
yeah.
need to...
Yeah, let's not...
Give me just...
Let's not say anymore. I just wanted Mike to say this is not unique to us.
We know that.
Can you state your full name?
Yes, Mike Cox. So, just like alcoholism, you know, there has to be an acknowledgement that there's a problem mm-hmm. when you can fix it. And there hasn't been an acknowledgement yet. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of discussion. I think people get polarized and see that, well, some people think that there's no way we can do anything, and then others want to do something, but they assume that there's too much resistance or it can never happen, and that's not true. But I think for something like this, we have to provide a fair amount of time for people to be educated, to be open, for information to be provided, outreach to be done, the varied opinions and situations that have occurred. You know, I've lost some trees and other things to the mule deer rubbing on them myself. So I do think that has, unfortunately, some of these places like white-tailed deer in the East, you know, it took them a long, long time to realize they were killing more with vehicles than they were with weapons during the hunting seasons. And now there's a plethora of urban archery-only seasons that have been instituted with they're highly regulated. And there's been programs where sharpshooters have come in and it's created a huge confrontation and kind of drawn the line in the sand. But I think there's a lot of passive things we can do to reduce people from, as Gil said, treating them like pets and human beings, and treating them like wildlife, and respecting them to be wildlife. So I think we disrespect them when we treat them like pets. But I think ultimately we're going to have to look at harvest. You know, we don't have people want to use bighorn sheep as a good example that we had bighorn wiped out in the state, except for about 3,000, and we can take them, and we've been very successful moving them. But moving mule deer has not really been all that successful, because mule deer live in every part of the state where they can. And if they're not living there, then there's not enough habitat. There's some habitat component missing. Mm-hmm. And it's been tried. There's been other states recently, Utah. I mean, we did it. We've done it several times, a few times in my career. Spring Creek. Dogs getting run over, women and children getting bitten, and just a lot of harassment. And we moved them, and either they all died or they ran, you know, 100 miles, and they never really settled down, and that's the behavior of a mule deer. So I think just that educational component of what are our options, what's viable, what isn't. But to bring the issue to the forefront, and it's not easy. Mm-hmm. I've brought, not that I was born to receive pain, but in my career, I've endured a lot of pain to bring issues up that people don't want to talk about. Some things have been resolved and others haven't. So I think the first step is you know, to acknowledge that we've got a variety of problems and a variety of opinions on the topic, and we need to speak intelligently, put your heart at the door when you come in, and talk factual and talk real, and I think maybe we can get somewhere. But
So you do believe there are solutions?
Yeah, but they're not going to be easy.
Oh, sure.
To get agreement or approval. You know, we have bighorn sheep that come into Boulder City, up towards about 100 of them, and they're all congregated, and half the homeowners love it, and half just taste it, mm-hmm. despise it. Mm-hmm. They're just tired of it, mm-hmm. tired of, and they've made a mockery of it, really. They've got tour buses now that come into it, and they're kind of oblivious to what it really is all about, and they don't really care. It's a zoo to them, but so I think we just need to be open about our concern, be polite, be respectful of others, but we've got to work toward a solution. And I think statewide, there really has not been, again, all these other communities have dealt with it, but they haven't really responsibly, or that they've had to deal with it, but they haven't really responsibly dealt with it. And maybe Carson City will be
the guinea pig.
Right.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Yeah. There is a lot of frustration.
Well, and don't forget,
what
you're talking about is something that is a wild animal. Mm-hmm. And I'm a long enough resident here, over 40 years, where I saw that 40 years ago there weren't any geese. And if you ever play golf, you know that's not true anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that deer are geese, but again, they're wildlife.
Yeah.
And don't forget, there are a lot of opinions and a lot of different ideas. You have Carson City here, you have anti-hunting representation here, you have hunters represented here. Mm-hmm. There's damage that occurs, there's potential threats, but it is wildlife. So you can't just say, wildlife, you're excluded. You can't put a fence around Carson City.
No.
So, but you're taking the right step, and you heard Mike is actually going to the commission meeting this weekend. Gil will be there,
good.
And that's a good place to start a conversation.
Yeah.
And I know Carson City is aware of this problem, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We struggle with it, too.
Yeah. So I did bring this back and open it up as a public comment. Mr. Volz, do you have a comment?
I do. First of all, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to clarify a point. I'm not anti-hunting, even though you've chosen to categorize me as that. I'm looking for balance in the situation. And what I'm really troubled about, Mr. Cox, I believe, was present when the idea was completely dismissed by former Commissioner McBeath on the Wildlife Commission. There are communities in the eastern United States that have successfully used the PZP vaccine in Maryland and New York, and that information was provided to the commission, documentation, and apparently nobody has bothered to look at that in all these months since it was provided back around the summertime. And I'd be happy to reprovide it, but the point is, there are other solutions aside from killing the deer. Whether it's with a bow and arrow or a gun, it doesn't really matter. So we need to look at that solution if everybody is throwing up their hands and saying they don't know what to do, and they're scared, and they're frightened, and they're this and they're that. That's science, and there's proof that it works, and it needs to be explored. Thank you.
See, that's why I
don't know what that is, but it's interesting.
Well, I'd be happy to provide you with literature if you give me your contact information.
We're sort of encroaching on bending some open meeting rules.
Right. So we are. I opened it up to public comments because you were here. And so we need to bring this back as an agenda item in the future.
Okay, great.
And I don't know that we're going to be the forum that's going to be able to come up with a solution, mm-hmm. but we'll certainly are sensitive to your issue.
I would comment one thing. I don't know what the gentleman has, but, you know, terrific if there's, you know, a humane solution.
It is. And basically, rather than killing the wildlife, what you're trying to do is to prevent an overpopulation in the first place.
Yeah, I recommend you do a Google search for Cornell University and deer control through deer control through birth control.
You know, I would just say, you know, in passing this up to the commissioners, is that perhaps they should consider it as a public safety issue as well as a wildlife control issue. I mean, I don't want to see a kid coming from Carson High School and have one of the deer basically take out a kid. or a card if you need.
Sure, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get out of your hair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, I'd like to move back to disclosure.
Sorry to jump in here. Sorry. My neighbors told me to be aggressive, so.
You have to be sometimes.
I'd like to move back to disclosures. Any other disclosures, board?
Nope.
I did have a disclosure. I did talk to Corey Lytle with Lincoln County Wildlife Advisory Board regarding board action item number 8, and their concern, they support that, the Colorado model, and what they wanted to make sure is that there is a limitation on the amount of funds that come up on that. Their concern was that if you put a, attach something on each tag, a family of four might end up with $2,468 plus $2 for a license plus. So I just wanted to disclose I talked to him. Seeing no more disclosures.
I don't know if it, this really is, I guess it's a public figure, but well, I haven't personally been engaged in talking to Assemblyman O'Neill. I have conversed via email with him about this Colorado model and have a potential meeting with him this week regarding showing him the DVD for the Colorado model to try to see if we can get some response from him in that area.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, and I've also let you know, plan on attending that meeting with our assemblyman and showing him that Colorado model. Okay, item number 7. Scott, I appreciate you coming, and I was hoping you could give us an update on where we are with improvements out there, and then we'll have some questions for you.
Sure, I'm sure you will. For the record, Scott Farnbrook, Deputy Director with Carson City Parks and Recreation Department. Kind of in chronological order, the existing Carson Rifle and Pistol Range, which I think everybody knows where it's at, out on Flint Drive by the landfill, is fraught with problems. One of the problems that we've been dealing with for decades has been a lack of a public restroom at the facility. It's not that we haven't tried. We've taken portable toilets out there. You know, vendors have provided portable toilets and they've been shot up. We've had to pay for the toilets, and you know, there's always the fear that somebody's going to be in one of those units at the time that they get shot, so it becomes a safety issue. The other issue with the Rifle and Pistol Club, the range, is security. Vandalism is almost a weekly occurrence out there, and so we have to deal with that as well. So what kind of initiated the latest round of rifle range improvements is we had a meeting several months ago at our Parks and Recreation office, and Chairman Martin was there along with Chris Vasey, who is now the state educator with the Nevada Division of Wildlife with Endow. And Chris explained to us their grant program and how they had improved the shooting range at Winnemucca by applying for the Endow grant. And Endow's interest in this whole thing is, number one, you know, they want to create and promote safe shooting ranges across, not just statewide, but across the country. They get so much federal money, and they don't want that federal money going back into the federal pot. They want the state of Nevada to use the money that's allocated to them. So we discussed it, and we talked about, you know, what we wanted to do out there. Endow's interest in it was that of course, Chris Vasey, a state educator, wanted to have hunter safety education classes out there. And so he recommended that we look at a building like they had built in Winnemucca, and I'll go ahead and pass some pictures around. This is some of these pictures of the building that we looked at the Winnemucca shooting range, built with this grant, and then the other ones were the portable restroom facilities that were built with this grant, and I'll explain it as we go. So that was his interest in it, and of course our interest in it was that we've always wanted to improve the range. We feel like if we can put some money, invest some money in the range, we're going to deter some vandalism. You know, hopefully the theory of, you know, you build something nice for folks, they're going to want to protect it. That's been our experience when we improve parks, when we build nice parks, we have less vandalism than we do in some of our degraded areas. So we're hoping that we can make some improvements. We have discussed these improvements with the Carson Rifle and Pistol Club. They have endorsed it. They have given us a letter of support. They are behind it. We've been discussing with them about a restroom facility for quite some time, not knowing what the problems are out there. We have a short-term solution right now. We have agreed with the Carson Rifle and Pistol Club that our department would pay for half, and they would pay for half of a portable toilet unit that would be on a trailer, and they could take it out on weekends and during their shoots. But obviously, that's just a short-term solution, and that doesn't help folks that want to go out Monday through Friday and shoot. So that being said, we took a trip out to Winnemucca. Doug couldn't make it, but we ended up making a trip out to Winnemucca and looked at their shooting range. We got a tour of the facility that they built strictly with the grant money, and also the portable restroom, which you see are the pictures. So from that, we took that back again to the Carson Rifle and Pistol Club board. They're behind it 110%. They want to participate in it. And so we are seeking not only seed money for the grant, match money for the grant, but also some private donations to make this a reality. Since that time, my director, Roger Mollendorf, and myself have put in a request to the city for $15,000 for match money. It's passed the first internal approval process. It needs to go to the Board of Supervisors with our capital improvement program for final approval. But we're asking for the $15,000 just to get the ball rolling and to get some seed money to make this happen. As far as priorities go, our first priority would be to install a security gate somewhere up on Flint, so when you come off of Flint Drive, you can't, anywhere from dawn to any time after dusk and before dawn, you can't get down to the facility, because that's typically when all the vandalism and the problems occur. So we haven't identified a specific location. It's going to have to be a location where they can't drive around the gate, obviously. And we want to have a security gate that automatically closes at dusk and opens at dawn, so that we don't have to pay an employee to go out there all the time and be the gate tender. Probably put a sensor on the range side of the gate, so if somebody does get stuck in there after closing time, they can at least drive out, but nobody can get in. Because we found that happens a lot too. People get locked into facilities, and then dispatch calls us and we got to go out there at 9 o'clock at night and let somebody out. So that would be our first order of priority, because we feel like if we start making improvements down there, if we don't have the security, you know, we're not going to be able to protect what we build. So first priority would be the gate. Second priority, of course, would be the portable restroom building, so that until we build the larger facility, we would at least have a way for folks to use a restroom facility. And the other thing with this classroom, you know, discussing about the classroom and the clubhouse building, that facility would probably only be open when either the city personnel are there, Endow personnel are there, or Carson Rifle and Pistol Club personnel are there. And if you know by some of our other facilities that the city owns, a good example would be the Capital City Gun Club. That's the Trap and Skeet Club out on Arrowhead Drive. The city owns that facility. We own all the buildings. The club helps us maintain that facility and run that facility. And we would probably be looking at the Carson Rifle and Pistol Club to do that same thing for this facility. One of the ideas that Endow had, and we really like this idea, is they have a regional game warden in this area that doesn't have an office. He works out of his home. So, yeah, go ahead and pass those around, Gil, to everybody else. And so they had suggested that this game warden have an office at this facility that we're going to build, which we would like, because this is a post-certified law enforcement officer, and we get a lot of vandalism, not only during the night, but during the day when not a lot of folks are out there. So just to have that oversight out there and that presence, we think would be a real boon for us to have that person out there. Again, as far as funding for it, we've got the seed money. We have talked to the Rifle and Pistol Club about how they can solicit some donations from private parties. Also, we're looking at any kind of in-kind help that we can get. If we can find, you know, some engineers or architects that are active shooters and that would like to donate their time. You know, sometimes A&E costs, architectural and engineering costs, are a big chunk of a public works project. So if we could get some help there, we could actually even find plumbers, carpenters, anybody that has some a skill set that we can use, surveyors, whatever. We won't turn anybody away, but if we can find some in-kind help, we can use that in-kind help as a match for this grant. So we're in the process of preparing the grant, getting it ready to go. We'll be taking that grant to the Park and Rec Commission and on to the Board of Supervisors once we get it prepared. So I'm ready for questions.
You know, I belong to a big club and I lived in California, and we got a lot of money from NRA because of, you know, one of the requirements to be in the club was to be an NRA member, and they in turn pumped in close to $70,000, you know, toward the buildings that we put up and the fencing and that gate that you're talking about. And every year we change the combination so the members, you know, that come and go wouldn't be able to get back in there. But the, you know, I think there may be other sources, hunting organizations, NGOs that, you know, are into conservation and education and stuff like that. It might be other sources to tap.
I'm glad you brought that up because we actually have some folks with the Carson Rifle and Pistol Club that are looking into that too, other sources. NRA's one, Pittman Roberts. We used a lot of Pittman Roberts money for the Capital City Gun Club, as well as some improvements quite a few years back at the Carson Rifle and Pistol Range. So,
I mean, I remember when I first moved to Carson, I was impressed with the shooting facilities that were available. And yes, when you go out there some days, you see the people shooting everything that is in sight. And, you know, you just wonder, you know, the signs on the way in, you see the holes in the signs. And it isn't just here in Carson City, it's every community that I lived in that had a rifle and pistol range where the public could go out to practice, and people just felt that's a sign that I'm going to shoot it. Don't know why, but there's a tremendous attraction. But I think in general, I'm all in favor of, you know, supporting, you know, the efforts of the community and the city and what they're doing. I think it's the right thing. And, you know, we've got a couple of instructors here in hunter safety, and I'm sure that having a nice place like that's pictured there would be ideal, you know, for instruction.
Oh, it would, yeah. Scott, are you going to be able to hit NDAL's time frame this year for the grant application?
Yes, we're diligently pursuing that. We're going to be going out with Chris again next week, and we're going to tour the Douglas County Range to look at their security in place. I've never been out there, but they have a gate, supposedly. I want to look and see how that's all set up. And, then we're gonna go back out to the Carson Range, because we haven't been up to the Carson Range with Chris, just to kind of talk about, you know, the layout that we would like to see with this building and whatever. So Chris has been working with us to make sure that we meet the deadline, because he'd like to see this happen as well. Like I said, their interest in it is to get this classroom built. So we're working with them. It was an amazing thing when we went out to the Winnemucca Range. There isn't a bullet hole anywhere. That place is just immaculate. And it's no vandalism. Everybody's bison. Everybody there is a range, you know, master, basically, because everybody takes ownership in it. And there is, like, you cannot find a trace of vandalism out there. Not even all of the signs, none of them have holes in it. You go out to our range, everything's shot to hell. So we've actually gone to the point of we use the foam boards now to put our signs up because we have to replace them every few weeks. So we're hoping that we can change the culture out there. And I think we believe that one way to change the culture is to improve the facility and make it better. So.
Oh, absolutely. And as you know, I am just a huge supporter of this. And you know, this ward, I think, has a responsibility to have a safe and a responsible area for sportsmen to be able to practice so that they're ethical hunters too. Mm-hmm. Something for you to take away. I did talk with one of D.G. Hand's boys, Duffy's boys, and I don't know if you know D.G. Hand Construction in this town.
Okay. You're talking about Logan?
Yeah. And Logan said, come here. Have Scott get a hold of me, see what I can do to help out. I understand that Winnemucca was so successful because they found a local contractor up there that took that on as mm-hmm. his pet project. And so, you know, if you can find three or five Logan Hands.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that would be a really good thing.
I'll definitely get a hold of him.
Sure. Yeah, and some plumbers, too. Mm-hmm. And I know everybody here knows somebody who could help you out with that.
Okay. EAWN would be one place to go. Mr. Miles is the new chair.
Oh,
Builders Association.
Yeah, Western Nevada Bond, yeah.
Is there any question one money for this?
We're looking into that, you know, SNPLMA and question one money. We're looking at anything that we can look at, you know, from a government grant standpoint, we're looking at internally, and we're letting the Carson Rifle and Pistol Club help us with the shooting sports grants. And we're still looking for those too, but a lot of the question one, and you know, we still have question 18 that after we build the MAC, you know, we might end up being able to get some money for that.
Yes, John.
I don't know if Chris has gone down to the Boulder City meeting this weekend, but Boulder City has a range down there, and I was there for the SHOT Show, and that's quite, they have a gate on top, and then you have a long drive to the bottom, and they have a Rangemaster and RSO that's there when they're open. If you're in Boulder City, it's worth driving to go see, just to kind of take a look at how it's set up and the layout in it. Might give you some ideas, not that you're going to redesign the range, but they have some unique things there that are kind of neat and some ways to get around. They can block off certain areas, so they can keep people from getting in. Say the sheriff's department's down there doing some shooting or whatnot, they can block that off without having to put up a barricade, and that they have a gate there. And so it's...
No, that's good. I got to drive to Phoenix here in about a month and a half.
Boulder City, you just go through town. Mm-hmm. It's on the southeast corner. It's a great range, and the rangemaster's very open to talk to you.
Did you say if that's private or run by the city?
That's run by the city, I believe.
Good. Good.
It's the Boulder City Gun Club.
We know some folks over there, too.
Yep.
So,
that's good information. Have you contacted the sheriff's office? Is there any flavor for them to use that if you were going to go forward? Because I know where I live, they use the prison. Medium security prison, and I can tell them days that they're shooting by the volleys of shots. They don't irritate me, but I can tell, you know, when they're shooting. So I don't know if there's an avenue there. I think that some of the answers to pardon me, the cultural changes that you're discussing there are to have a more and more of a law enforcement presence there. Mm-hmm. It's an excellent idea with Endow, and also if the sheriff's office could shoot out there once in a while, they probably want to close, but I don't know. That might be worth a phone call there to Kenny or some subordinate to see. Yeah. But.
We actually had a meeting with the sheriff's department because they actually wanted to block out days of the week where just law enforcement could shoot out there, and we said no because we didn't want to do that. But we did say that, of course, we will reserve the facility anytime law enforcement wants to go out there. You just have to let us know. If it's open, we'll reserve it for you. But we told them, too, as well, that we encourage them to use it as much as they can because the more, you know, nothing's going to happen when they're out there. We did have a conversation with Sheriff Furlong and also Ken Sandage about the fact that we're building this facility and they're all for it. Because they know that there's a lot of problems out there. You know, mm-hmm. They said that the few times that they've gone out there after dark, there's been a lot of people out there at the range. They can't be up to any good.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I teach hunter safety with John, and one of the things that we had to stop 15 years ago was live fire as part of hunter safety, and. You know, there was just no place to do that, and that's one of the reasons why that Winnemucca facility was so attractive. Not only that, but the security and some of the things I see out there, Scott, that are from not from hunters, are just from people out there. It's scary. It really is. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
It's not a safe place, and we hope to make it a safe place.
Yeah. No, that is super. Stan, anything to add?
Well, I know I've been to the Winnemucca Rink, both the old one and the new one, and you're right about when you have a good facility, because the old one was also vandalized and stuff, and then when they built the new one out there, now I haven't been inside the building, but I know it's taken care of very well, and a lot of the people, you're right about the people having ownership out there too, is, you know, even though we were an organized group when we were using it, we still had members coming up to us, and you know, basically they're telling, this is what we want out here, and mm-hmm. things, which, you know, is perfectly acceptable, and I could see that, you know, there was a big change. Just like you said, there was no vandalism out there, where the other one there was, that's for sure, the old one.
And the more, you know, the more people use the facility, the less vandalism you're going to have. We found that out, so it's, you know, you get 20, 30 people out there enjoying the facility, you're not going to have vandalism during that time. It's when nobody's out there is when you have some yahoo showing up, and that's where you get the vandalism. That's where you get the problems.
And I assume you've talked with the owner of the Coyote Tractor Sales. He used to be S&W Feed. He's on the Pistol Club, and I was talking to him about this, and he was just so excited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He shoots all over the state. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have him.
Any questions from the public for Scott?
It's great.
Yeah, we're excited.
When's your application due?
I think the first one's due in April, and so we're really pushing to get it wrapped up.
And well, one thing we could do is for action, bring it back just for an action item, a letter of support from this board.
Okay, that'd be great.
And our next meeting is March 16th.
Get on here.
March 16th. So we can put that on the agenda if you can give us a draft.
I'll give you the details.
And you can just get that to tomorrow.
Okay.
Super, thanks.
You betcha.
Nothing else on that item?
I'm interested in how much it's going to cost to
yeah.
the grant as well as whatever public money for
free. Right. We're hoping to get a design so that we can narrow down the cost.
Moving on to item number 8. Scott, you're happy to, you're welcome to stay, or you can, I know you've had a long day.
So. That's okay, I'll take off. I'm just going to make some notes.
Okay.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, thank you for coming.
You bet.
Moving on to item number 8. There has been, as we saw, the Colorado model, there has been a bill draft that's been developed. It's bill draft 616, sponsored by Senator Hammond. And what it would do, it would take that Colorado model, it's taken that Colorado model and made it into a Nevada educational bill draft. And the state's wildlife, Nevada Wildlife Coalition, which I think is chaired by Larry Johnson, is that right? Yeah. They're requesting feedback from groups, sportsmen's groups, CABs, and they'd like to know two things. One, do we support such a thing or not? And then two, funding for such a model. They're proposing fees on licenses as well as tag applications. And I've already indicated that Lincoln County supports the concept, but they're concerned about overcharging people for paying for it. So I didn't bring the Colorado model again to show it again, since we've already seen what it is. I didn't think it was necessary to do that. But I would like to have a discussion about, do we support that? And if so, could we, I'd entertain a motion regarding that. So.
Well, I also had to start off with a motion saying that that we should support it, and then we can get the discussion, we can discuss it unless somebody wants to discuss it prior to that. So I would make a motion that we support this endeavor through BDR 616 as it relates to the Colorado model.
I'll second.
Thank you. All right, so discussion regarding that?
Well, I think there's, the concern, I basically have the same concern. You can get out of hand with collecting the fees. as far as if you're going to start put a surcharge on everything. Mm-hmm. And basically that's what we're talking about. You know, I have no problem. I like the idea. And it was my assumption that it was a voluntary fee in Colorado at the time. Mm-hmm. Something like you would check or something if you were
getting it. No, it's a
mandatory fee.
It's a $2 fee that goes on every license in Colorado, and that $2 fee generates approximately $1 million a year, and because they sell that many licenses.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing would be is that when you're looking at things like tags and stuff, is that a fee if you apply for the tag or if you get the tag? You know, which would make a difference on a person.
Oh, sure.
You know, sure. And those are all things that are, you know, basically, we're not going to work out here. It's going to be worked out at the legislature.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, you know, that's just my, you know, a concern.
And I think I share that same concern. So. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, you know, there's been a lot of talk, you know, at various meetings about we haven't seen an increase in fees, licenses, and tags, and things like that in quite a while. And because of the needs of the department, you know, there's talk that we might be seeing some increases. So again, the sensitivity of how much it's going to be and what it's going to be applied to, I think, needs to be seriously addressed by the bill makers so that we don't overburden the people who procure the licenses and tags, because if they see a whole bunch of stuff coming at them, there's going to be some real pushback. And this is a good thing. And whether it's $2 or it's 50 cents, I think they have to start with how much do we need to raise to support the program, and what's the best way to get it, voluntarily or mandatorily by, you know, it's going to cost you X dollars or X cents or something to raise the money, what they have in mind, their goal. Now, there may be some other methods that we could employ to raise funds for this, maybe on a voluntary basis for people to send in a tax deductibles donation to it. I mean, there's a number of different ways to skin this cat, and I think, you know, the legislative luncheon that's coming up in March might be an ideal place to gather some thoughts from a lot of the NGOs and some of the sportsmen that will be present, just to see, test, put our feet in the water and see what the reaction might be from some sportsmen that are there that may not have seen the videos or read about the Colorado model. So it might be a nice thing to have maybe a display about what it is.
Right. No, that's a good thing, yeah. And my conversation with Larry and Mike Bertoldi with that coalition is that's they want to bring that to that meeting.
Right. All right. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, yes, because it's an educational program, can some of the funds that are raised through the sales of firearms not be used for that? I'm sure Colorado's looked into that.
I think, yes, they did, and that's the answer I got, is that they did, and that's not eligible.
Because there are probably some matching grants out there for educational purposes, because that's what it's for. It's an educational program.
Right.
To inform the public, and so and there might be something there. There's another means.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you, Don, and I think, you know, any message that anybody gives to the Nevada Wildlife Coalition is look at optional funding sources. You know, I totally agree. Jim, do you have any comment on this?
I think everybody's covered it. I think Gil, you were right. It's in terms of fees, I guess it was standard, well, in terms of fees, that we could preach that all day long, but the legislature, based on lobbies and whatnot, will determine where that buck and how much of that buck is assessed.
Exactly. Right. I think that one's out of our hands.
Yeah, really. Yeah. I mean, as far as, you know, our board is concerned, the question is, do we want to support it? And I think that's the motion.
That's the motion on the table. Right.
On the table.
So I see a couple of people, or at least one person from the public, open up for public comment.
I was just, Doug, going to comment that the Pittman Robertson funds that we get for wildlife restoration, there is a percent that's earmarked toward education, but it's strictly hunter education. Strictly hunter education. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably how and why
Colorado
confirmed and determined. You know, I got to tell you the story. It was a former commissioner who was a rancher. And I was in Las Vegas at the time as a regional supervisor. And our hunter education coordinator had heard, because he's a friend of mine, that we were beginning an elk management planning process for Lincoln County. And he felt that it was his duty to help get sportsmen involved in the management of elk. And that if they don't show up at the meetings, you know, they're not going to know to participate. He went and with the list of hunter education coordinators in the state, elicited their interest in the meeting coming up, the first meeting, the inaugural meeting of the Lincoln County Elk Management Plan. And just so happens that the commissioner was a hunter education instructor himself. The instructors got the letters and or the emails. And so he was anti-elk. And he made a huge stink that you cannot use your staff to educate your constituents to participate and support the management of wildlife. And I was just like, what?
Okay.
I guess it goes against democracy. I don't know. There's something important to do to save our society and reduce pollution. You know, don't we want to educate our publics that the bad things to do and the good things to do? And but I don't know.
Was he a commissioner anymore?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. He got multi-millions from the Southern Nevada Water Authority for his water rights. Oh, I didn't say that.
Any other public comment?
Yes, for the record, Fred Volt. I'd just like to amplify a few things about this issue. First, in NRS 501-100, which is kind of the overreaching, overarching piece of statute that governs wildlife in the state, it's to protect and manage wildlife. It's not to promote the elimination of it. And what's being proposed in item 8 by Senator Hammond, who is a government high school teacher in his day job, so it's kind of surprising he doesn't understand the distinction here, but it is not the Department of Wildlife's responsibility to promote the elimination of wildlife. It is to protect it, it's to manage it. If private organizations such as the Wildlife Coalition want to do this on their own, that's fine and dandy. They can raise the money, they can do the promotional effort. It is not state government's job to promote their issues for them. And they need to be very understanding of what the statute calls for and really not pursue it. It really is ridiculous that they would think that they have some sort of mandate to do this. It's not within the purview of state government to do this sort of thing that they're proposing. Thank you.
Any other comments? Bring it back to the board. Any further discussion? And I entertain a motion.
We have a motion.
I'd like to call for the vote. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? None. Thank you. Stan, you got to spend some time at the commission meeting. And
yeah, it was a pretty...
Have a report for us?
Actually, it was a pretty uneventful meeting. It was a two-day meeting that easily could have been done in one day. Actually, it was, I was kind of surprised how quick everything went through. The, one of the things that Commissioner, or Chairman Drew mentioned was that the way he's going to conduct it is that workshops are going to be held at one commission meeting, and then the vote will be held at the next. And I don't mean like it's going to be on Friday and Saturday. It's going to be at, you know, like, and which falls in line with the one that we were concerned about, which had to do with bonus points. They had the workshop there, and then supposedly it was supposed to be, it would be finalized or voted on at this coming meeting, although I never saw anything that I could tell that directly related to that, and that was the bonus points on the first, whether or not you lost your bonus points on the first come, first serve tag, which they were trying not to lose your bonus points. I really, I don't know if, unless I missed it somewhere in this agenda of this meeting, I didn't see where that was going to be coming up.
No, and, I didn't see it either.
Yeah, I didn't see it either. But anyway, that point was made across at that meeting. I mean, if you read the minutes, I spoke about it, as well as there's others that seem to be on the same same page, that they didn't think that a tag's a tag. If you get one, basically, no matter how you get it, you know, your bonus points, you know, you're not going to maintain your bonus points after that. The only other thing I'd like to bring up is that they did do a presentation on the biocritical habitat assessment tool, which I didn't know was available online. And basically, it's you can go on to the NDAO site and you can bring up State of Nevada, and you can might be able to explain this a little better than I can, as far as bringing up a point in Nevada, like I brought up Prison Hill after I found out about this, and then you can see its overlays of critical habitat for where, and if you have them all on there, you got a big block. You know, you got to select some off if you're to find out and things, and through the Habitat Division, they developed that, and that's available online. You can just go right to their site. Yeah, it seemed like this was something that had been brought up for years. Like, we've always get these proposals for wind energy sites and things like that, and the, you know, there's always somebody coming up, well, this is in that area, or that's in that, you know, I remember the one we were concerned with had to do with sage grouse selects and things. And one of the comments that was made during that, I remember being at that commission meeting, was that the industry says, well, why don't you give us a map where we can put these sites in, which is something that NDAO doesn't want to, you know, you know, it's not NDAO's job to do that, it's not BLM's job to do that or anything. You know, you make the application. Well, this would provide the information to the company. It's available right there, to where if they're going to look at, you know, if they want to put in make an application for a lease, a wind energy lease or whatever, in advance, they can go there and they can see what kind of critical habitat you're going to be up against in those areas, right?
What I like about this, it's a pre-planning tool that anybody can look at it.
Anybody can look at it.
Interesting thing on that, Mike, is who's doing the input on that? How do you get the data?
Chip Van Dalen is our GIS specialist, and we are actually collaborating with all the Western states.
Yeah.
And so Chet's been to, you know, Phoenix and Denver and Salt Lake City, trying to standardize. I don't know if it was a big focus from the Western Governors Association, but they wanted a consistent approach that all the states could have. Because, you know, for example, these multi-state pipelines or transmission corridor lines, they want to say, look, you can, we want you people to start thinking more responsibly now than coming in and piecemealing and trying to take a path that's inappropriate through various states that will damage a lot of wildlife habitat. And so he worked for almost 4 or 5 years on that. But we've got data sets that we can tap into and then ourselves. So much of it is our assessments based on our best available information of where sage-grouse want to be, where blue-grouse want to be, where mule deer, where bighorn sheep, antelope are, and where we've documented them. And so it's something that we wanted the industry to take a look at. It's just frustrating that the industry doesn't care. And it's almost like when I tried to get all these wildlife crossings built earlier in my career, we thought, hey, let's go to the Association of Car Industry, Car Association Insurance. It's car insurance. I can't remember their acronym, but there was a national car insurance, vehicle insurance, and like, don't you want to reduce the paperwork and the collisions and the payout? And they told us under the table, we don't care. We'll just increase the fee. We don't care about your wildlife. And so, we've tried to provide the industries out there, they're going to continue to rape and pillage our wildlife habitat, an opportunity to reduce and, not have as much mitigation. But some of these are so brazen, it's like, whatever, we got the money, and we'll just rip it through there and make it happen. And so I hope somehow that we can place more responsibility and requirements of these industries to seriously look at that data. But it is a great tool.
Yeah,
and you're right. It wasn't just Nevada. It was through, I think, the Western governors got it going and everything. And originally, when he was giving the presentation, he was covering, Idaho, Wyoming, Utah and everything. But what's available at the Indale site is only Nevada.
Okay.
From what I understand, that's all I could figure out. I don't know if you went to Idaho's site, if you'd be able to get there or not.
Like I think they all were trying to play together and say, by a certain date, we all have to have our data available. Because if we start asking industry people early on in the process, hey, go to this site and please take a look at it first before you start designing and identifying alternatives. So,
great. Okay.
Actually, that's all. Yeah.
That's it? Okay. Thank you, sir. Look forward to our report next meeting.
Yes, sir.
All right, now getting into the really fun stuff. We've got proposed regulations, and there's quite a few regulations coming up. Let me just suggest that this is the consent calendar, and we can approve these in block. We could pull some out. I look at B through F is certainly ones that are kind of pro forma. But what I'd like to do is open it up to the board and see who would like to pull what to discuss further. Starting with, are you ready, John?
No.
Mr. Paul, do you have any that you would like to pull from the consent calendar?
I don't.
Okay. Mr. Yannick?
The only one that I'd like to just discuss a little bit with to hear from Stan, because I read what was said about this is item 10J, the carrying of firearms during the archery season, and it also want to include falconry. Because there was a comment by some people who were falcon hunters previously, way back when I attended some a meeting in Winnemucca and I talked about falconry as it applied to sage grouse. And all of a sudden, I got to talking to the falconers and realized some of the challenges that they have out in the field. I was looking at it from the standpoint of, if the season is closed for sage grouse hunting, how come you guys can take sage grouse with falcons? I mean, that got changed. So, I'd just like to maybe discuss the issue a little bit more with Stan to hear what was actually, not printed in the minutes, but what was said at the meeting.
Okay, so that's covered in 10J also. Yes. So you'd like to pull 10J?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Zuber, are there any of these you would like to pull?
Well, it was going to be that one, but also, any other one I think would come under 11. That I would want that when we move to the next one.
Okay, those are other items.
Other items, yeah.
Right, okay, all right.
That and then, regulatory.
And then I would like to pull 10G and like to discuss a couple items on that. So, we have, board members have requested pulling 10G and 10J. I would entertain a motion on the balance.
Are you going to take the public comment first, Mr. Chairman?
No, this is our consent calendar, Mr. Bolts.
These are action items, all of them.
Yes, they are, and they are on the consent calendar. So all we're doing is acting on the consent calendar.
Okay, then I'll save it for the end.
Okay. Yep. So, I would entertain a motion on those.
I'd like to make a motion to accept all the items on item 10, except items G and J.
Thank you.
Second.
Second. Any discussion? More discussion? And seeing none. I will take public comment, and Mr. Bush, do you have something you'd like to add?
I do, please. Regarding item 10A, the commission has had a very checkered history in terms of trapper reporting, and the question that would seem to need answering here is, aside from not renewing somebody's license, what enforcement mechanisms, if any, will there be to audit the information that is provided by the trappers? Specifically, we have thousands and thousands of non-target species that have been impacted by traps, and the reporting on that has been, if we're lucky, we think maybe 20% to 30% of the total trapper population. And that would seem to be a major, major issue that needs to be addressed to ensure that the reports are accurate, since it is all self-reporting at this stage. And it's only as good as the, shall we say, accuracy of the individual who chooses to report that information. Thank you.
Any other public comment? Seeing none, I'd like to call for a vote. All those in favor of accepting consent items, except 10G and 10J, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. 10G, Mr. Cox, I'm glad you're here. There's some questions that I have. What I'd like to do is maybe run through this, and Mike has put together a good summary of justifications and explanations for pronghorn, elk, sheep, and mule deer. And maybe for the sake of brevity, I just have some questions on elk. So if people have questions in other areas, maybe what we can do as far as streamlining this whole process is just focus on those where we have questions. So I would like to discuss elk. Okay, is there any other? Okay. Mr. Cox.
Yes.
You have put together a couple of things in your summary justification explanation. The first one that is of a little concern to me is item number one, which is the Santa Rosa Range has grown large enough to support a limited tag quota for bull and cow rifle hunts. First question I have is, do we have an elk management plan for that area?
No.
Okay. So with that answer, could you please go into a little detail about this is not a transplant. This is a voluntary migration by the elk. Is that correct?
Yeah, they pioneered in.
Pioneering.
Yeah, they pioneered in. Probably a combination of coming in from the east from Area 6, and then probably coming down from Oregon. And it's been building. So the would we have preferred to have an elk management plan completed before we had a harvest program? Yes. But didn't happen. So we felt we need to be responsible and start harvesting some of these elk. And we don't have a great sense of what the ultimate outcome will be in the process, which we're hoping to start, which would be the entire Humboldt County. It would just be the Santa Rosa. It would be the entire Humboldt County elk management local planning process this fall. And well, we felt that it was necessary to begin to responsibly manage that herd, not knowing what levels or acceptance there would be.
Well, where I'm going with this is we'll get into, obviously, if we create this unit, then we'll have a quota. If we create a season, then we'll have a quota discussion
right
later, and that will be based upon science of how many we have and what's your objective. But while you're on the topic of pioneering, are there other pioneered ranges that should also be considered, the pine forest or whatever?
We're not aware of enough elk in other parts of the state that would support harvest. So we are aware of elk that are dispersing but not have technically pioneered an area. So if you want to provide, I can be the messenger to say, hey, take a look at this place or that place, but
right.
No one's come forth to me to say, hey, we've got large enough herd that can support harvest.
Well, by adopting a season in, and I don't know what unit that would be called, I think it's
051,
right?
Yeah, 051.
If you put a season in 051, that doesn't mean you're going to fill it with a quota.
It does.
It does?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, you're going to
we're not playing games.
That you recommend.
We're not playing games here.
Okay.
We have every intention to set a quota.
Fill it with a quota. Okay. All right. Any questions regarding that? You see why I'm asking the question.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Anybody else have? I have one more, a couple more on elk, but while we're going down the list here.
I have more of a, your first deer is more of a comment rather than a question or anything, but
what do we say on elk for right now?
Yeah, that's all. Okay. I just want to make sure.
Anything on elk?
Yeah, it's not, Mike hasn't addressed it here, but you know, I've been looking for years at the amount of tags that we give landowners in exchange for the damage that has occurred on their property. And the amount of money that these landowners get for some of these tags is, you know, and I've heard stories about people planting alfalfa fields without any protection around them, knowing that the fields will be populated with elk. And they call the game wardens out and say, see? And they say they reel off 3, 4, 5 tags that go for fees $3,000, $5,000, $10,000 a piece. So I think, you know, we've opened up an opportunity for people to take advantage of a system. And I don't know how people would feel about this, but rather than giving them elk tags, antlered elk tags, give them cow tags instead of elk tags, because number one, we'd be getting two things out of that. By eliminating more cows, we help reduce the population, and we stop people taking advantage of a system that wasn't ever meant to be worked the way some of the ranchers are working it. I don't know how receptive ranchers or landowners would be to the change from bull elk tags to cow elk tags in exchange for damage to their property. But I sure think it's something that needs to be looked at, because I think people are gaming the system.
Mr. Chairman.
I don't know how the department feels, but I see it more and more, and I hear the stories about the fees that some of these people charge and advertise. You know, here, you know, come get a trophy elk, and it's only going to cost you X thousands of dollars. And I tried a couple of years back to say the department ought to share in some of that money for education, for damage control, and things like that, but that didn't get off the ground. But I'm saying this idea would, I think, put a crimp in people trying to game the system, purposely plant crops, with the intention that it will attract the elk.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not a farmer, and I don't know what it costs to plant alfalfa and pay for water, but if you're going to put a field out of 120 acres of alfalfa and grow it and not harvest it just to bring it out to get an elk tag, you best be selling for a lot of money, because that costs money.
Those fields are free.
I don't know.
I don't know what cost of their investment
water is. An acre of land in the valley.
Mr. Chairman, one additional comment to dovetail into that. That's a two-edged sword in my opinion, and I think there's no doubt some legitimacy to what you're saying, but there's also some landowners who get tags that forfeit those tags or have those sold to be auctioned off the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, which I happen to know a couple of years ago, there was over 50 grand went up for tags there that went into Rocky Mountain Elk, which then turned around to benefit the species. So it's a two-edged sword, but definitely probably worth looking into.
But as far as the seasons go, that's more of a global picture what you're discussing here,
yeah,
rather than the seasons.
Yes.
Right. So I actually do have a couple things regarding these seasons that are being proposed. And if you have your list that Mike sent us, if you could turn to page 13 and then go back, I believe, two pages to page 11. I just want to point out something on the elk seasons that he's proposing. And going to page 13, on the bottom of the page is antlerless elk management muzzleloader hunt 4476, option for mule deer hunt 1371. He's proposing a season of September 10 through September 30. The department is proposing that, Mike. Sorry. There's no bullseye on here. The department is proposing. So if you go back two pages, those are what is referred to as the muzzle loader delt tags. Okay? deer elk tag.
You get the elk, don't get the elk in the deer.
Right, right. So he's proposing to, the department is proposing to put those people in the field who have that elk tag on September 10th. Now go back two pages on page 11. The resident elk antlerless muzzleloader hunt. These are people who specifically want to go hunt cow elk with a muzzleloader. And the department is proposing a season, with one exception, of two exceptions, of September 17 through September 30. Okay? So you're all following me. So what happens is that the deer elk muzzleloader cow muzzleloader hunter is in the field 7 days prior to the person who specifically just wants to go cow hunting. And so the next thing I asked, well, the next thing I did was I called Mr. Cox and I said, could you please just pick on one area, unit 13, and please tell me what happened in the year 2013, 2014, in relation, and I said 2013 because there was no Delcon, okay? And then I said, tell me what happened in 2014. Well, the first thing that happened was the number of tags for cow muzzleloader hunters was reduced for that hunt, 4176. So they took tags from that particular hunt, and then there were tags put into the 1371, that elk hunt. So then the next thing I asked him was, what was the hunter success in 2013 with those cow hunts, those cow hunters with a muzzle loader? And I think it was somewhere around 66%. And then what was it in 2014? And it was down in the 20s. Then I asked Mike to say, ask him to look up how many overall elk were killed with muzzle loaders. And actually, I believe in that particular unit, and Mike will either say yes or no, they actually killed less total elk between the two, even though there were more tags, double the number of tags than were there the year before. So I just look at all of that, and I just go, one of the problems to me is that you're letting those people who have that deer muzzleloader tag in the field 7 days before the people who have just the muzzleloader tag. And I know Unit 13 fairly well, and I know that Mr. Paul does too, and I now know that Mr. Valley does too, and he's part of that 25% figure.
No, I'm the 75% figure. I didn't get one.
Well, you're part of that crowd, yes. You're the three out of
I'm
four.
I'm the majority.
and so I just look at it all, and I just go, all right, I understand the reasons that they proposed the Delk thing. We'll get into the quotas when they have the quotas, but now we're setting the seasons. And I'm wondering if it wouldn't be appropriate to have, under the Delk muzzleloader, let the person start hunting deer on the 10th, that's fine, but don't let them hunt
beyond
a cow, elk, until the 17th.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask my question?
Yeah,
under return cards, do they tell you when they harvested?
Yeah.
How many harvested in those 7 days? What percentage of the
Delk
hunters
were
there? Weren't that many, but what was there an advantage for those 7 days for elk?
Well, we focused, I actually did some analyses, but I focused on the rifle just because it was the biggest impact out there. And unfortunately, the muzzleloader season is the only of the three seasons that we had the cow management tag, I think the dump tag was kind of too cute, so I try not to use it in my vocabulary. But the cow management tag that's associated with the deer hunt, the combination deer elk tag, the muzzleloader season is the only one where the advantage goes to the deer hunter with a cow tag in their back pocket. And there's, as Doug says, there's 7 days where he's going to start, the deer muzzleloader season starts September 10th. And I hope that he's focused on deer hunting, but the whole point of having that hunt was to say, well, if you happen to have an opportunity, it's your choice if you want to try to kill a cow before a deer. And as I was honest, as unfortunately most people know, I'm sometimes too honest, I told Doug that I looked at that retrospectively, and I think that was unfair. Although I think we didn't know how the sportsmen were going to approach that hunt. We thought it was going to be kind of like, very minimal, and it was. It was in the teens. The hunter success of those cow management tags was below 20%. It was 12 to 15%, because we put a large percentage of the deer hunters and gave them an opportunity to buy one of these cow management tags. We didn't think they would be all that serious. And I think it somewhat backfired. In Area 13, in the muzzleloader hunt. So really and I did a little bit more homework on looking at Area 6 and 7, and comparing that to 13, what happened in 13, what happened in 2014. But the deer hunt, our deer hunt starts October 5th, the deer rifle, and the cow rifle starts October 1st. So that was flipped appropriately, where we have committed cow elk hunters. They don't put in for bull. They've never put in for bull tags. They just put in to kill meat for the freezers. They just put in for cow elk tags, and regardless of weapon class. And so in that case, they still have 4 full days that they can go out, kill a cow without any deer hunters, without the mass humanity out there, and without the additional competition of these combination deer hunters with a cow tag in the back pocket. Archery the same way. Deer archery starts September 10th, or in August 10th, I think. Archery cow starts August 1st. They have a full 10 days to be in the field without having competition. The muzzleloader, and it was an oversight, but I didn't think there'd be this competition. So it's an interesting suggestion. We just simply took the season dates of the deer hunt and said that would be the season dates for the cow management hunt. But there is nothing saying that we can't restrict. I mean, that tag has to be within the deer hunt, but it doesn't have to start at the beginning of the deer hunt.
Right.
And it's a sizable season length. It's three good weeks. So you could start it September 17th or even the 20th.
The 20th would be even better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And say that, hey, knock yourself out, focus on your deer tag. But if you didn't find what you wanted, you found some cows in the process, and their behavior, it's still going to be, the rut behavior is going to be even stronger later. You probably have a greater chance of finding those elk later in that muzzleloader season. So there you go. The social process provides you that suggestion.
So let's go back to John's question. Do you have that information handy in unit 13?
Yes. So, and I have a
How many?
An opinion of why.
Muzzleloader tank were issued.
Yep. And I think what had happened is we wanted these cow management hunts where we have huge elk populations, where we have elk distributed uniformly across the landscape. We have that in 6 and 7.
Right.
We really do. And they are sympatric with mule deer herds, with mule deer hunting opportunities. And I think it's lesser in 13. There's pockets of elk in Area 13 because there's pockets of habitat. There's a lot of poor habitat for both deer and elk in 13. And so I think it didn't work as well. It worked well. We actually felt it worked well regardless of the weapon class, where we had kind of ubiquitous elk across the landscape, across the unit group, and it wasn't going to cause any grief. But the other thing that there was no... I sometimes say that my job is herding cats. And it's a difficult job to herd cats. There wasn't any criteria given to our biologists last year of who, we encouraged people that were, which is 95% of our herds were over population objective. So we strongly encouraged every biologist to participate in this program. Well, you can see we had just a handful of biologists that suggested a hunt. I browbeat some others, but they chose not to. Ignore my browbeating. So we had, every 6, 7, 10, and 13. And they could have chose to have one or not, but the other thing they thought they needed to do, especially in 6 and 7, was one of the reasons we were asking for this hunt was they had so much hunter congestion, which we haven't really fixed quite yet. We're still working on it. Of the deer hunt overlapping the cow rifle hunt. And that was that weapon class, that October season was the biggest frustration out there. Mostly in Area 6, but a little bit in 7. And what they felt like they needed to do was reduce the tags to the standard cow hunters. And I'm not sure if we needed to. In fact, in some of these hunts, they didn't. So, for example, in Area 6, I can't use Area 6 because it's apples and oranges, and I don't want to get into that. But Area 7, muzzleloader, cow season. In 13, there was 203 tags. So in Area 7, 203 muzzleloader, cow tags. In the September, end of September season, without a cow management hunt combined with the deer. In 14, there was a cow management hunt applied with that deer hunt, and there was 219 cow muzzleloader tags issued.
So a few more.
A few more.
Right.
So a basically equal amount, but then the biologist said, on top of that, I'm going to issue some cow management tags. Well, the interesting thing was she hadn't warmed up to it as much as others. She only, I don't have the quota. Well, the quota was fairly high. I should retract that because it was the harvest that was low. We only harvested 10 cows with people with a cow tag in the back pocket that were supposed to be deer hunting. And so it wasn't a ton. There were, for Area 7, the 4476 hunt. There was only 33 tags. So we didn't recommend a ton of tags. But the message is, we didn't take away any tags from the cow muzzleloader. The core standard, and I think that needs to be the message that we have some dedicated cow elk hunters in archery and muzzleloader and rifle. And we understand that you as an agency need to harvest more elk. But what we saw in 13, this is my professional opinion, is we have scattered populations. We've had long-term cow elk hunters. And they know how to hunt. And they know how to kill elk. And we took tags away from them. And then we took away our successful hunters. We put those tags into the deer hunters' back pocket, who kind of cared or didn't care, really semi-didn't care.
It
was an opportunity, but they weren't going to go out there and do it for the team. If it was an opportunity, they'd do it for themselves, and a lot of them didn't. And as data bared out, as I showed Doug, and he already picked up on it, we killed less elk in 13 that is over population objectives for that hunt. Now, we made it up in the rifle hunt, but I think for these small quotas, there was no harm, really. We should have increased cow muzzleloader tags. I mean, it was 17, in 13, having 17 tags, and we dropped it to a dozen. I mean, crummy, we should have went up to 25. And on top of that, the cow management tags in the back pocket of the deer hunters. So I think we were wrong in reducing that quota and thinking that, oh my God, the sky's going to fall, we're going to have too many people out there and we're crawling all over each other. But I do think that your idea has merit, is start that cow management elk muzzleloader season. A little bit late.
Great, thank you.
It gives them a reason to be there.
Well, and I really appreciate that, because what I just heard a lot of, but one thing I heard that my take home message was the rifle cow management hunter couldn't start that hunt until 3 days after that rifle cow hunter. So the success rate was probably just as good for that cow rifle hunter in 13 as it was in 13 and 14. And so I heard that, and then I also heard the department say, you could say that the cow portion of your cow management muzzleloader could start at a different date. So when I heard that, that's a great idea. And if you could take it from the 17th, and move it to the 20th, that gives that person who wants to hunt cows a reason to. And I just asked John, a friend of ours, actually shot one of those under that, and he shot it at the end of the season, right at the end of the month. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's why I brought it up, and I see merit in it, but I don't know about the rest of you. Sunday.
Yes. We have to look at the intent. What was the,
Well, I will show you for the rifle, and there's probably some similarities between, and this is in area 6, we're in 7, where there was a lot of elk sharing the landscape with the mule deer. I thought we'd see the cow harvest of the cow management tag holders later. They were going to focus on deer.
So you're telling me they're right around the 5th, huh?
Yeah, so if I look at the harvest, we had on October 5th, and let's see, we harvested total in Area 6, for example, with the cow management tag, 60 cow elk, people that had top cow tag in the back pocket.
On opening day.
But they should, 60 total.
Oh.
Because during the entire deer season, they harvested 60. But on opening day, they harvested 10, which is the most of any day during the entire deer season. There was 10 cow elk right off the bat with people with a cow tag in their back pocket. And at 7...
Well, they did, yeah.
There was 13, and that was the most in a single day.
Yeah.
There was...
And I can tell you, when you shoot a cow, you're not going to be focusing on deer hunting for the rest of the day.
Or the next day.
Or a couple of days.
Yeah, yeah. But what's interesting is... I thought, because I ran some numbers, that the elk hunters, or the deer hunters with a cow tag, you would see them being unsuccessful with their deer tag. So if anyone with a combination of, you know, a deer tag and a cow elk tag in their back pocket, if they did harvest a cow, I'll bet you anything they were unsuccessful in the deer hunt. And it wasn't the case. And so basically, there's this small core, may not be small, may be big, of our hunters that are really good. They're really dedicated. They know what to do. They know how to prepare them for themselves. They know to prepare to how to deal with a 300-pound cow and a 150-pound deer. And so more, there was more people that were successful in killing a deer that killed a cow. And the ones, there was a lot more that were unsuccessful with both. They're just not that great at deer. They're not that great of a hunter. And so it's interesting that there's a core. And I don't know if that's going to play out. I know, maybe they get burned out. And, you know, it takes a lot to eat a cow elk in 1 year. So it may not be interesting this year in killing your cow.
You don't know my son's family.
Good.
Yeah. And you know, the interesting thing is, I know, and we have a common friend, Dave Stanley. He only hunts cow elk now because he got his bull. And he just said, I had that experience, and so now that's all.
Kind of a lifetime.
And here's another one, you know. There are people who just say, let someone else have that lifetime bull hunt. I'm going to go hunt those cows. So you're right. We do have dedicated cow hunters. And so, anyway. I think we beat this one into a horse, but or beat the horse to whatever. What's that saying?
Beat a dead horse.
There you go. Beat a dead horse. Thank you.
But I'm just concerned about, you're definitely going to need some education if you're going to go the route of an alternate starting date. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that people
understand
it. Yeah, because, I mean, we threw a ton of confusing new
right
hunts to people last year, and I think they're still reeling. I mean, I think people were paying attention that got a tag.
Oh, I got this. They look at the bonus feature of it, that you got one in your back pocket, you do this, and you see that. No,
it was probably more on the application process that was right confusing. I think once the tags were issued,
right,
it's pretty clear.
Well, and I know your application process well enough that you can, when you click a certain tag, up pops a message, and you have to click that you read that message.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know you guys can do that.
Yep. And we would do it definitely for them. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure you
Well, by the way, this season, right, clearly, again, we
might be a couple of public service announcements and that whole new radio program you have. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
My question, so in area 6 and 7, it seems that dog tag had no difference. The extra days made no difference in the harvester. You had a higher success. Did you meet your objectives, your harvest objectives, in 6 and 7?
Yes.
With the cow elk?
Yeah.
And over the whole
We harvested class. More and we achieved. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
But there were some areas that you didn't meet your objective, and so those are the ones
that I think we should
have. Maybe we can tweak a little.
Yeah, like 13.
Okay.
And
Well, I hear where you're going on that, John, and I don't know if you want to take each one of these individually. I think you could blanketly, I think it would be less confusing to the general public than if it was just September 20th through September 30th, you could harvest a cow with that particular tag.
If
don't change and don't mess with anything else. Leave the rifles the same, the archery the same. Just take that one.
That might be the statement that a sixth of the cows were harvested the first day.
Well, that was the rifle hunt.
Right.
That's the right one he's talking about.
And
you're talking about the muzzle.
I'm just talking about the muzzle.
I didn't pull the harvest dates for the muzzleloader season.
Right, he didn't. Right, and I'm just talking the muzzleloader.
Yeah.
Leave everything else the way it is, and just tweak that. So
I mean, I would entertain a motion to do that from someone to change just the muzzleloader portion, which is on page 13, that the muzzleloader cow portion of that tag start on the 20th and run through the 30th. See, right now it's the 10th, mm-hmm. and you compare it to the guy who goes out there muzzleloader hunting, he can't get there until the 17th.
But yet the archery and the rifle hunters.
Everything else the same, yeah. Anyway, I would entertain a motion, and if nobody wants to entertain that, we can go somewhere else.
No, I think from all the discussion that we had, it makes sense, and it achieves the objective at the same time.
You know, we might see a few less fallow harvested, but to be honest with you, the bulk of the success of meeting our objectives was from the rifle cow management hunt. We harvested 10 cows in Area 7, there's 2,000-3,000 elk up there. There was only 10 that harvested with a cow muzzleloader tag in the back pocket, and if you were to take 10 days off, it may only be 5. But we're harvesting 300 with a rifle. And so I think we knew, I mean, really, if push comes to shove, we would probably eliminate the cow management program with the muzzle and archery, because it's not that successful. In fact, we did with the bulls. We saw almost no harvest with people with a bull tag and a cow tag in the back pocket, which makes sense. I mean, that's huge. That was priority. Almost once in a lifetime. They're just not going to mess around
with a cow.
No. There was, and then I think, I'm sure, if the ones that were did kill a cow, it was probably on the second to the last day. They passed up, bulls that they just didn't feel like they wanted to harvest, but they still wanted elk in the freezer. So I don't think... We would. There's no sword for us to fall on if you change that season date. I don't have to see that. I'm not going to fight it. Well, I'm the one that would fight it.
Well, and I don't know that I have a motion here, Mike. So it doesn't matter.
Is that Hunt 4476?
That's Hunt 4476.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I move that we. Change those that we recommend that those dates be changed from September 10th to September 20th for Hunt 4476 for the 2015, 2016,
2017 season. And a point of clarification on that is for the cow portion of that.
Correct.
Hunt only.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we do have a motion.
I'll second.
I didn't catch the last two areas.
Okay. It's Hunt 4476, and that we recommend to the commission that they change the starting dates from September 10th to September 20th for the 2015-16 and the 2016-2017 season.
For the cow?
For the cow.
Portion.
The cow portion
of that tag.
Right, exactly.
That hunt number only is for cow muzzle.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, so you're right, Jim.
Yeah. So we have a.
Who seconded?
I second.
Deal. So, discussion. Mr. Valley, you have a concern on this.
I'm just wondering why we have to go 3 days after everybody else, but I was just thinking the 17th might be a more, just to be consistent, if you want to be consistent when the muzzleloader guys at the field, that's when you can take muzzleloader cow.
Mm-hmm. But,
as opposed to the 20th, it's 3 days. I mean, it's...
I understand that.
So I'm just saying, you talk about confusion, you've changed the season, which is now split anyway, so you've added that confusion, but then you got a cow tag, I had a delk tag, when you start?
Right.
So now I start 3 days behind you now.
Right.
Because once
instead person, of 7 days in front,
instead of 7 days in front, now yeah. 3 days behind.
Yeah, because he's going for the 17th. This group's going to the 20th.
Right.
Which is the same confusion
as what we have.
Consistently confused for the archery and the rifle.
The same deal.
Right. The deer rifle gets. They have to wait until the cow rifle hunters are in the field for 4 days, mm-hmm. and the archery hunter, the cow archery hunter, has to wait or doesn't. They're out there 9 days before the cow archery with their deer tag can start. So,
but does the cow archery tag and the elk archery tag start on the same day?
No,
they don't.
They don't. Nor does the rifle.
Okay. There's my answer.
Yeah.
So we're being consistently inconsistent.
That's right.
Yeah. And John, just to let you know in discussion here, I was thinking the 17th also. But when Mike was saying that the rifle hunt, the rifle delk people, mm-hmm. or count management, they start 3 days after those.
That gives you 3 days.
Why not do 3 days?
Yeah, that's fine. At least that's consistent across the board.
Right.
But you're not going to have all those.
Right. So.
I understand.
Stan, any more discussion?
On this? No.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Any public comments? Thank you for your input, Mike. Seeing no public comment, I'd like to bring it back for a vote. All those in favor of that particular motion, which is just this hunt, signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye. So, what's that?
Yes.
Yes.
Are you okay with that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had his questions answered.
Consistently confused.
So we had no questions on pronghorn. Any other questions on elk?
Yes.
Okay. Bighorn sheep. I don't have any questions on that. I don't see any. Mule deer. Stan, you had a question on mule deer?
No, it wasn't really a question. It was just a comment. Mainly with the seasons for 021 and 015.
What stage are you on?
21. Well, that's just part of it. It's also, yeah, 21. And that has to do with the rifle season being 21st of December to January. And I just wanted to, you know, I really appreciate that being at that time because that's right during the winter break for the school and everything. And I know back in the early 90s, it didn't used to be. It used to start like right after, I think it was the first week of December. And I just, you know, I think that's really good having that there that close to, especially on 021 to a big urban area. My son at one time, and I've been wanting to bring this up during this time for the last couple of years, I kept forgetting. But my son had a tag for that area at one time, and we spent, that's probably one of the best 2 weeks we had, trudging through the snow and everything while he was trying to, you know, find his deer and everything, which he chose not to take, the, you know, we found him, but he chose not to take the shots at the time. But, you know, not having to yank him out of school in order to go do a hunt and things like that, I think that's there's more value in that hunt than just to be able to hunt the migratory deer that come over from California in there at that time period.
And is that a change from last year, Mike?
Well, it's been there a few years.
Yeah, it was about 5-6 years ago. The intent mm-hmm. wasn't to accommodate the Christmas break of high school, but it was to, one, it was two things. One, recognize the interstate deer movement, and two, provide parity amongst the weapon classes. Because what we had was the only season that accommodated the migration was the rifle season. The muzzleloader and the archery seasons were in the August-September period, where, you know, we only have 10% of that deer herd
over there.
You know, on our side, until the snow pushes the deer out of California into the Nevada side. So it was kind of, it was inappropriate to say, hey, archery hunters and muzzleloader hunters, knock yourself out and beat yourself up. So we decided, look, based on data, based on information of that migration, without climate change, it was pretty much December 1st. And so we decided we're going to carve up the month of December for all three weapon classes. And we figured, let's be appropriate and let the archers out there first, the muzzleloaders out there next, and then the rifle hunters get the last season. And it just so happened to be, you know, the last that Christmas break to accommodate the rifle season. But we haven't had a lot of movement. And we've had some severe fires that have impacted that deer on the California side. So. But appreciate the comment.
Quick question on that. That 015 unit, is that in either the Buffalo Hills or the Poodle Mountain area?
Yes, that is 015. That's within.
That's what I thought.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and I'm sure you're familiar with the document we have in our which is the, I think it's called the Reed Bill or the Sagebrush Enhancement Bill. Sagebrush Enhancement Bill. And in there, I don't know if you've looked at this, but Buffalo Hills Wilderness proposed is 45,000 acres, and the Poodle Mountain proposed wilderness area is 142,000 acres.
Huh.
So I don't know if you've looked at that, but it's certainly going to impact that hunt. So, anyway.
Other deer hunts?
What's that?
Other deer hunts?
What do you mean?
Do you have questions for other deer hunts?
No, question, just a comment. No, I didn't know if you noticed that there's proposed 200,000 acre withdrawal from that particular unit, 015.
Yep. I'm a mushroom on some topics, so.
Well, yeah, when you get all this stuff and you read it all, you go, is this connected to that?
There was a couple of years back, there was when Carl came to one of our meetings and we were talking about the hunts that we have here.
Yeah.
And to determine whether or not the species, there really was that movement of the California herd over the hill into this area. Did that ever come to some conclusion?
We've got a pretty solid idea of what percent of the overall herd and how many that is, but we haven't published it.
Okay.
But really, basically, the everything south of Spooner Summit is always resident deer. It's always resident deer. So it's really everything north, and it has to be. It's really north of Hunter Creek, mm-hmm. where we get the migration, and then in 192 for Douglas County. You know, they've got deer that do come out of the Carson River drainage, Hope Valley, Carson Pass area, and they do make their way all the way down to the north end of Carson Valley and find their way in the Genoa Peak, Bliss Peak on the south end of the Carson Range. But the Carson's portion of the Carson Range
still on Wild Oak Mountain, Topaz, and when there's a foot of snow on the California side, and if you just have to hit it right there, you have to get out of the way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Historically, we had, you know, thousands of deer that would migrate over into the pine nuts, but we whacked and stacked them with cars. Massive humanity took care of that deer.
I guess so.
Thanks for lack of education.
Following on to Stan's comment, Mike, I do have a question for you. Are there any other units that you have three now that are bi-state area? I mean, Unit 8. 015 and 021. Are there any others that are by state that would be appropriate from a management perspective that also would give more opportunity, like Stan was saying, for those family events?
Well, we just, you know, the 194 portion of Area 19, the 192.
Douglas County.
Now we have a November hunt that includes Thanksgiving. So the season dates currently, and I'm going to go to the 1107 hunt for the juniors.
Well, isn't that 201 hunt? Isn't that what Jim was just talking about down on Wild Oak Mountain?
Yeah, Area 20 is the Walker River herd.
Right.
And
well, I'm just wondering, looking at that and listening to what Stan said, looking at this one.
So the area, let me just start at the top. So we already covered the Area 2 and 015. That is at December 21st to January 1. And then we move down in the units. 081 is the interstate herd with Idaho and Utah. That's December 11th through January 1. So that includes a high school Christmas break.
Right.
For, you know, Elko County, I guess. But, I mean, anyone can drive up there from Carson City if they wanted. And then moving toward over here, we've got 192. That is November 5 through the 30th. Which does accommodate.
Yeah, you get Thanksgiving. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's a pretty good break. And that's the same season that we have consistently from there through Area 19 and including Area 20. And that's November 5 through the 30th. So we have that Thanksgiving holiday season for the Loyalton Truckee herd, for the Carson River Interstate Deer Herd, and for the Walker River Interstate Deer Herd.
Right.
And then that's pretty much it. I mean, we have a little bit of deer movement down in Clark County between Arizona, so there are those seasons that do provide a few extra days because of the holidays.
That's good.
So, looks like they looked at that, Stan. I mean, they didn't look at it from your perspective, but it falls
maybe off. Maybe
it's Thanksgiving
inadvertently.
Oh yeah. Great. So, are you happy with the dates that you see in here? Any?
Oh yeah.
Any other comments? Any other comments on deer, Mr. Paul?
No.
No. Okay. All right. So I don't see any comments on any of the game species regarding the seasons. So one of the things we need to do regarding item 10, what is it, 10G? G is we need to move on an action on all of those items other than the one muzzleloader elk hunt. So I would entertain a motion that we recommend all seasons as proposed by the department, with that one exception, if someone is so inclined.
I'll make a motion to accept all the seasons as presented, with the exception of muzzleloader. What was it? 4476.
4476.
4476 for the previous motion. As presented.
I'll say.
Any further discussion? Public comment? Seeing none, call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Okay. Mr. Yannick, I think you asked for this to be pulled. This is item 10J on the firearm in the field while hunting archery.
Yeah, I read the discussion that was held, and I think there's a valid point. And I just as we felt about the archer out there, I think the falconer had an equally justifiable situation about he's out there with his falcon and, you know, coyote or bear or snake, whatever he can envision, he's doesn't have anything left to protect himself with except his falcon. And I think that the whole issue, because I remember my first archery hunt, I kind of felt unprotected just because I had been so used to having a firearm somewhere in the event of, never needed it, but in the event of. It made sense, and I think that do we open the door for people to do things that we don't want them to do, or to put them in a position where they have the opportunity to do something we don't want them to do? And you know, that's a two-edged sword again, you know, about do you give them the capability and expect them to respect the fact that it's only for use in an emergency and not to hunt with. So I bring it up to get other people's opinion. And then the question about a barrel length, minimum 8 inches. That's a heck of a thing to lug around. I look at my Ruger, you know, Red Hawk, and I don't want to lug that sucker around all the time. So I bring it up because I'm not sure, and I don't see a problem, but maybe I'm overlooking some things that other people would bring up.
Yeah, well, what was brought up during the workshop was the main reason was self-protection, and that in archery hunting, it's kind of a solitary experience. You don't really archery hunt necessarily in groups like you would with rifle. And so that was the concern. And I guess there had been incidences. Some of the archery organizations got up to where, particularly in female archers that had been accosted in the field and were, put into positions that they felt that they needed, you know, personal protection other than just with their bow. And if you look, they went and rewrote the regulation to include that you can carry a firearm. But they wrote it as such that it's not a legal hunting firearm that you can carry with you. That's the reason for only up to 8 inches. And
I think the 8 inches is under 8 inches, it's not over.
Oh, it's under. Minimum.
Yeah,
right. Maximum of 8 inches. Okay.
And it can't be scoped, and right. You know, there's right. Several other things that make a legal handgun that you can hunt with, to where these would be handguns that are not legal. Okay. To hunt.
These are more of the concealed carry handgun that it's talking about.
Other than a
hundred, like a 380 with little six, you know, those little tiny things that, yeah. You know, you can't even see mine in my pocket.
But, you know, basically a police officer could carry his duty weapon out there, and it wouldn't have to be, it doesn't have to be concealed and things.
Right, so that answers your question.
Yes,
Chairman, I have a question.
Well, let me finish this just for a sentence. The falconry was brought up. And basically what seemed to be the agreement with the people from that represent falconry, they're going to be discussing with the chief warden, and we probably would see something similar coming up under their regulations, because I think they're handled, even though they were looking at it at this wasn't the regulation to change. Mm-hmm. To, you know, would have no bearing on that. So they, you know, we could be seeing that in the future something. under their regulations coming up.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Good.
Well, you might have partially answered my question. My first question is it statutorily? Does anybody know? Is there a statute right now that says that falconers can't take a weapon?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, which I was kind of surprised
about. And then the other one is a comment, and having first, secondhand knowledge of this from a close friend of mine, Hunter, who had a less than 8-foot confrontation with a mountain lion while he was bow hunting, and kind of an overgrown little tunnel, where he had walked out to a ledge, or crawled out to a ledge, in a really tight compartment, if you will. He had a full face mask on, and his he had two arrows laying here, and he picked up one of the arrows and turned around and saw the cat and said, if we're going to have it out, at least I can stab him with an arrow. It's the law of the jungle. He wasn't upset about it, but I get the defensive thing, particularly with the women. So I don't have an issue with this at all.
That's an interesting story. I'll get more out of that. You have any comments?
I had a confrontation with a cat in the shelter with my son during his season. Luckily, there was a stick there. The cat just kept walking. I think we pushed him out of his bed. He was asleep, but he was from me to the end of the table, walking right around behind us, and then just walking on the ridge. So I told him. My son saw him, too. He was pretty calm about it. Brad, he was 12. But I couldn't carry a weapon in the field. And so it was like, well, okay, fine. Make do. And we saw that cat three other times up on that hill over the duration of his season.
Okay.
But
so I think we're all ready for a motion on this, Gil, and I'll let you go ahead with it, whether we support this or not.
Yeah, I'd like to make a motion that we support the ability of the hunter, archer, or falconer to be armed with a sidearm.
Carrying personal protection.
Okay. I'll second it.
Okay. Further discussion? Public comment? Seeing none, call for a vote. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. We're moving along. Actually, we are. And we're not bad with this agenda. Stan, you had... This is for anything else on the agenda, if you want to pull anything to discuss further. Stan, you had one item?
Yeah, I guess it'd be under the commission's agenda, it would be item number 7, I believe. The bear, 3-year comprehensive review report, or plan, not a plan, it's a report.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, we'll discuss item 7. Are there any other items that you would like to discuss? Anyone else, or Stan, anything else?
No.
Gil, any of the items?
Yes, sir.
Okay. While we're discussing things, I'll just have a really short, I promise, discussion on the item regarding the draft bill that Jeremy has.
It's Chair, I don't have
item number 10.
I don't have your packet.
Oh, you don't?
No.
Okay.
So what we'd like to discuss on the department's agenda. This is anything else on the department's agenda?
Yeah, I don't have that.
Okay, so
we need to be a little more specific.
I will be very specific. We will like to discuss NDAO's agenda item number 7, entitled Review and Consideration of the Black Bear Subcommittee Report. Okay? And then the other one is item number, again, NDAO agenda item number... it can't be 10F. Yes, it is. Item number 10F, reports.
Nevada Sagebrush Landscape Conservation and Economic Development Act of 2014.
Any other items to discuss? Seeing none? Stan, let's start with item number 7, the bear report.
Yeah, I don't know if, you know, the report was included in the package, at least it was in mine, and I also attended a lot of the meetings for a year now, or over a year, I guess. Actually, I attended all of them.
It is in the packet, by the way.
Yeah. And basically, the reason I'd like to pull that out is I would like to recommend that we support this report. It's not perfect, but the committee put a lot of work in on it, and the committee passed the report that's being presented to the commission unanimously. And so I just think that it, you know, it has a direct effect in our area, and I think we should support that this report goes on forward to the that the you know that hopefully the commission will accept the report and forward it on to the legislature like they've been asked to do.
And you would like to you. Like to support it as written.
As written.
As written. Okay. There is one particular item since we brought it out that I thought, since Mr. Cox is here and he's a biologist, perhaps maybe we might want to make a recommendation on something, and that would be on page 2 of that report. In your packet, the report starts about halfway through, and it looks exactly like that. You got it. And on page 2, you're right there, Gil, you're there. Okay, on page 2, it has a recommendation that the commission shall consider retaining a season structure and harvest level that does not decrease the population size of black bears in Nevada and should consider season structure and quotas annually. And I just get concerned about adopting something into perpetuity that everything can get changed. But when you adopt it, I'm just saying it might be good to say unless such a request is supported by science. Regarding decreases. I don't know that you always want to adopt something that there will be no decrease in population. I think Mr. Cox right now is asking us to decrease the elk populations of the state of Nevada. Is that correct?
Yes.
So I don't know about just saying that you will never have a decrease in black bear populations. And I think if it ever got to the point where Mr. Cox was going to say we need to decrease black bear populations, he would. I don't think this really ties your hands. If you ever got to the point you needed to decrease black bear populations to make such recommendations, is that right?
I don't know. That's in the report.
That's in the report, and that's the recommendations. They're recommending that the department adopt these recommendations going forward. So I don't know what
so
they.
So it'd be a non-affecting harvest level.
Right.
However, I think there is a statement in here, and maybe for, because it was Fred's recommendation that it does point out that the commission could increase, decrease, or eliminate the hunt. And that's included in here. I can't find it exactly.
I think it's at the very beginning.
Is it at the beginning?
Pretty close to it.
Yeah, it was.
But I think it's the first couple of paragraphs.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. I just didn't want to. I didn't want to tie somebody.
Yeah, I don't think that was
the last sentence. The commission remains receptive to the possibilities of continuing, amending, or eliminating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, And amending would cover it.
Okay.
All right. I withdrew anything I have to say.
No,
it's there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other discussion on the bear?
No.
So, Stan?
Yes. Can I ask a question? When the committee proposed accepting this summary, was a vote taken of all the members of the committee? Was there a lot of dissension, or did everybody fall in line and agree to it? Because we had some people on the committee that were against the bear hunt.
Right.
Did they vote in favor of this particular comprehensive summary?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, and
they discussed it line by line, actually.
Yeah, and there was
for portions. For 6 hours.
Yeah, there's portions.
Yeah, well, I knew that from...
Well, it was a long time.
Long time.
But, I just wanted to make sure that this wasn't a majority vote, that everybody understood that they had their opportunity to amend, change, and everybody walked away with the best deal they could get.
Mm-hmm. I think that happened. I was there last meeting.
I was kind of surprised. I figured, it might be a majority.
Yeah.
But I didn't, it was unanimous. But they would vote, they would even agree. Yeah, like I said, it went line for line.
Wow, that took a while. So, no further discussion on that. Since we pulled that, and you would like to give a specific recommendation to the commission, I would entertain a motion.
I'd like to make a motion that we support the commission adopting the three-year comprehensive review black bear harvest through regulated hunting in Nevada.
As written.
Perfect.
I would second that.
Any more discussion on the board? Public comment? Seeing none, bring it back to our vote. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. Second one, I'm not asking for a motion of support or not. All I want to do is make you aware that there is a bill out there that is more than what the title says. The title says that it is to provide protection for sage-grouse habitat and for other purposes. It's the other purposes that I'd like to make you aware of, and this is the very last item in your packet. Title one of it is economic development, and there are significant, under that, section 102, there are significant covered land conveyances, and a conveyance is giving away.
Transfer,
exactly. And then when you go further into this, also wanted to go Title II, which is local land conveyances and community enhancements. And then there's many conveyances to local government, and a lot of those are for local government needs. And then the next title is going back here, let me get out of conveyances. There are under Section 208 conveyances to the claim industry has, the mining industry has submitted proposal for consideration, and the next one is the mining industry has submitted proposals for consideration. So I just want you to be aware that under these Section 210, 211, the mining industry will be conveyed land. And I know that some people are concerned about where those lands are being conveyed and that they may be in significant wildlife, both game and non-game habitat. And then lastly, I just wanted to say that under Section 301,
there are significant wilderness preservation components to this. And I know that Churchill County, for example, made comments to BLM on the recent resource management plan. I don't know where you got these desert Koya wilderness idea, but it didn't come from the county commission. So I'm just saying that there's a lot of proposed wilderness in here. For example, item E, the Poodle Mountain Wilderness, certain federal land managed by the Bureau of Land Management comprising approximately 142,000 acres, as generally depicted on the map entitled Washoe County Sagebrush Wilderness, shall be known as the Poodle Mountain Wilderness. And then there's also the Buffalo Hills, and that's why I thought I'd point this out, that this bill is out there. And there are people who have concern, and I know that the Nevada Wildlife Coalition is certainly looking at this from a perspective of conveying lands to private entities that may impact wildlife resources. So be aware of it. That's my suggestion. I don't know if there's any questions, but
should I make the signs now?
Yeah. So anyway, I know that Jeremy, Drew, Chairman Drew, has a specific interest in this, and his specific interest is, focuses on those conveyances to the mining industry and how will it impact wildlife. So he's got a good, from a wildlife perspective, he's paying attention. So, anyway,
that was... question for Mike on this. The definition of a water resource, and it excludes guzzlers.
Mike, there was a question for you.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering, maybe it's just more of a personal feeling. They have in this bill a definition of a water resource facilities, and it specifically excludes guzzlers as not a water resource facility. Has the department had to deal with that type of this definition before?
No. What's the agency, what's the intent of that bill?
Well,
the convention, there's a lot. As it says here, to provide protection for sagebrush habitat and for other purposes. And
well, that's, okay, it's the same one.
But, yeah, but there's the section after that. That was just the definitions. The after that is
so what is the definition of a water resource facility? Well, water treatment?
Irrigation pumps, reservoirs, water conservation work, aqueducts, canals, ditches, pipeline, wells, hydro power projects, transmission of other auxiliary facilities, water diversion storage.
So they're not going to say, hey, you can't build a water development because it's going to destroy sage-grouse habitat, and there needs to be mitigation for that.
Yeah, then at that which point, it goes into a whole water thing.
Right, which is hopefully the intent.
I guess my concerns on that would be guzzlers development in wilderness areas. Like that.
Well, that's a totally other topic, and that has no authority over the current federal regulations over development in wilderness. I mean, I don't think they can alter that with these builders. I mean, they can set aside lands, they can identify lands to be wilderness. Then once they do, then the prior management that's already in place in federal law mandates how things will be managed within the wilderness.
Yeah, one of the things, when I was working in the California desert with BLM and the wilderness thing came up, it was the big question was when an area was made wilderness. There was grandfathered activity that was allowed, and a lot of it was, so if you if a water company had a reservoir that all of a sudden came wilderness and they historically drove in there, they could still do that, you know, with restrictions. They just can't drive in there anyway. But the original access, but what was California Fish and Game now, I guess it's
Fish and Wildlife
now. Their problem was is their guzzlers, particularly out in the desert, weren't included on that, and that they were going to have to, you know, they wouldn't be able to drive to their guzzlers.
Feeding on what you just said and what you just said, if they're excluding guzzlers from water development resources, perhaps those wouldn't be given access. I don't know. All I'm saying is pay attention to this bill, please.
No, we don't want access to them, but the problem
you don't want access to guzzlers?
We do, right. But if we're going to put them in the wilderness, we accept that fact that we're not going to have access. But the problem is they won't even allow them to be built to begin with.
Right.
Yeah.
In a wilderness area.
Yeah, we've only had one built in the state of Nevada, which is down in the Del Mars, or Nevada Valleys, actually, where a water development was finally approved and built within the Nevada Valleys wilderness area. And we don't drive to it.
It looked they had a wilderness and nobody came.
Yeah,
they're getting close. The Mormon Ridge might be one of those.
All these legacy issues.
Yeah.
The presidents look on the map and go, look at all that land.
Yeah.
It's like Thomas Jefferson.
I like the way you shuddered. Okay, item number 11. I think we've pulled those two items. We discussed them. Discussion regarding advisory board member commitments, upcoming meetings. Gil has committed to going to the one in Las Vegas. He really likes Las Vegas.
Well, what actually is this Boulder
City? Yeah,
City.
Boulder City.
Boulder City.
Yeah. You sure had your letter, so you don't have to pay.
Yeah, I did. I got
I'm just scanning.
Oh, I thought you're putting on your coat.
That too.
Okay. The meeting after that is going to be March 20th, 21st. I don't know if anybody's going to be around, available. I'm trying to get everybody to attend meetings. Stan and Gil have gone to the others. John, do you have any time?
I can't take a Friday off, but I can go on Saturday.
Okay, perhaps on the 21st?
Mm-hmm. I'll check.
Right. We're teaching a class the week before, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we are.
My schedule fills quickly.
And I don't know, Jim, if you'd want to, or if you could go to the March 20th, but think about that and let me know.
Okay.
On the 21st.
Future agenda items. I think we have one, and that would be dealing with Scott and getting a letter from Scott. Okay. All right. If we could.
Yes, I will let Kathy know.
We'd like to do a letter of support for the Capital Gun Club. For the Carson City Rifle Range improvement.
So, are you going to write the letter?
I asked Scott for a copy of a draft, so hopefully, and I said, please send that to tomorrow, and then forward it to me, please.
Yeah, I heard that.
Okay.
I'm sure we'll get it.
You're on. Okay.
Excuse me. Yeah. I'll get it from
Gil. Any future agenda items? Do you see?
No, sir.
Jim?
No.
Maybe.
Okay.
I'm having a problem, and it's not in our jurisdiction in the Scripps Wildlife Management Area in Washoe Valley, but I had the opportunity to be out there hunting and was, I would call, harassed by a guy on a quad and a girl in a truck who threw mud all over my decoys and ran up and down and ran back and forth and continued just to go out there and do donuts in the middle of the wilderness in that management area. So I called 911 and got Washoe. I told him it was an emergency. I called Washoe County Sheriff. It's out of our jurisdiction. So I called the Sheriff's Department down here, and they said, call Fish and Game. And I did not have Jake's number. I now have Jake's number on my phone. And I would have called Jake and said, I got him. Come here. They're right here. And the problem was the front bumper was removed from this Suburban. No identification. as a suburban wheel, I pulled my binoculars to look. They were about 300 yards away, and it was completely, of course, mudded across the back where I couldn't. There was a plate. There was a plate.
Not legible.
No. And they obviously drove in. They didn't trailer the quad in. Yeah. But you could use borderline harassment as he saw my decoys and then came around the lake and charged at the decoys and then locked it up from me to Mike and then looked around like, uh-oh, what's going on? And so I sat up. He had no idea I was there. So I sat up, saw me turn and ran back, but then continued to, at 300 yards, just tear up that place. And the problem is the jurisdiction seems to be it's going to be an end now. It's a management area. So, you know, who owns it? I mean, Ducks Unlimited has a piece in there, Northern Nevada, Ducks have a sign up there. But the problem is when there's no water,
yeah,
it becomes a free-for-all.
Well, I think that's a
and maybe some signage of,
yeah,
no driving off this established road, or no driving down this point or something, because there are established roads out to the edge.
Right.
And I've talked to Jake about it a couple times now about, hey, you know, where, how can you drive out there?
Can
you
not drive
out there? How far can you go? What can be out there? You know, does it have to be a vehicle? Can it be an ATV or UTV? Does it have, do you have to go on foot? Can you, yeah. And there doesn't seem to be a real clear definition at this point. And maybe signage would be all it would take. But I know Elmer used to go out there relentlessly. I mean, Elmer checked me a dozen times out there in 1 year, and it got to the point he saw my truck and just waited for me because he just wanted to talk to me, see how things were going. And that was fun. That was fun. But it was almost, you know, I talked to a couple people about it, and they said, well, that was harassment. They can't do that. They can't harass others in the field. That's illegal. Well, define that for me.
Well, maybe an agenda item then would be to have somebody
have Jay come to
from Endow, who's in the wildlife management program, come and explain to us, because a lot of people use from Carson City use that management area.
Absolutely.
I'd love to know, answer that question. Where is the management area? Are motorized vehicles allowed in the management area?
It's defined and no.
Well, and
so I know that enforcement is the issue.
Correct.
And enforcement's the issue.
And what are you going to do next year when there's no water and that lake is dry?
I'm going to take my quad out there and run down.
Well, yeah, that's
because that seems to be the thing to do. Well, and it's a problem. There was a guy stuck in the middle of the water show with the white pickup. Some of you may have seen it probably 3 weeks ago. I was sitting at the boat ramp at East Lake, off East Lake Boulevard, sitting there, and the sheriff pulled up. And I said, you're going to go help him? He said, absolutely not. Yeah. I think the beating he's getting at home is going to be far worse than what I'm going to get.
Before Mike gets out of here, I have some anecdotal information I'd like to share regarding how you opened the meeting today.
Right.
And being a 40-year-plus resident here, I've seen deer migrate down Coons Lane 35 years ago when it snowed hard. I've seen deer live on Hot Springs Mountain during the winter and heavy snows that didn't live there the rest of the year. And the strip between the prison on Fifth Street and the Indian colony,
yeah,
that entire area, mostly from Coons North, the deer habitated that area as little as 10, 12 years ago. And I've walked Prison Hill Trail System for over 30 years,
right,
and those deer have, by dogs, in my opinion, this is the anecdotal part, by dogs have been run over to the other side and live in the willows along the river on the way to Mexican Dam there, where they get least harassed by running dogs. So this stuff on the west side interests me a little bit because of the dog issues, and I know there's a leash law in Carson City, but there seems to be a profound class of lazy deer, if you will, on this side, but not on the east side. It's completely different on the east side where it is more open, there's less roads, but I've had deer eat my roses and eat, you know, everything there as little as 10 years ago. Now, when I still walk it today, seldom do I see prints. And when I see prints, it's usually a doe and a fawn, and they're usually running, which tells me there's been a lot of coyotes that work that range there freely that come right into, well, Solomon and Coons would just use that as a landmark. I've seen coyotes in the residential area there. So slow cats or whatever, you know, they're coming in to eat, but they're all over that mountain. And they pack up a little bit in the winter time. So I think there's another deer factor there that perhaps doesn't get it on this side as much, but it's just all anecdotal. But I have 40 years of history of this valley and a relationship to deer and other critters in it. But
well, maybe that's a good agenda item for our next meeting, is a discussion of the Carson City urban deer herd. I like that, and you know, somebody's going to start that ball rolling with these these people. They're definitely passionate about what's going on, but you can't put up a fence and say no deer allowed.
Yeah, I you know, if you wanted them off your property, I guess you know, there's people I know who use firecrackers, you know, to startle them, to get them running off, to stay away from their property. But that's just a short term thing, and I think Mike's totally right there. You have to have the commitment and the gut to go to a long-term management plan, then the funding and everything else that goes with it. But there's definitely a welfare class of deer living on this side.
Well, let me add something, because I've been corresponding with Roger Molendorf and Supervisor Abel, Chair Furlong, and Ann Bollinger. I'm going to drag Tony into it, and Jake into it, and Mike into it, because that's the kind of people that you need as a nucleus, who really know what the heck they're talking about, who have faced this problem before, maybe not here in Carson, but I know Tony's done it in Lamille, and some other places, and there's a lot of other communities around the country that have done certain things that may not be applicable to Carson City. And we have a unique situation. I mean, I've always believed that. Every community has a unique situation. And the social mores and the attitudes are different here than they are in some places in Colorado or Arizona or Alabama, you know. So, you know, I'm just trying to gather a lot of information, get people together who know about this issue. And
you mean that issue?
Mm-hmm. That was I had 20 deer in my front yard.
If you notice, they look before they cross.
Because they're from the cemetery.
And you're right. There's a difference between the east side and the west side and the herds and what they've been used to, who gets harassed, who doesn't get harassed, who gets fed and who doesn't. I think we'll
steer this for a while until somebody takes it over. But I have on here urban deer herd management.
Do you think that the deer herd that we're having here now is rutting at the same time as the other herds, or later?
Same time.
So the false rut that we see going on is just truly a dominance thing? Because this buck that I had a picture of was fighting with another buck in my front yard when I heard him. I mean, he was fighting. He didn't want, Dave didn't just, want any part week, of each other. So I'm assuming it's a false rut.
He said this week?
Yeah. Which is a little late.
He still has antlers.
Oh, yeah, he's got nice.
Yeah.
You can drop him in the front yard.
There's sparring going on, and it doesn't always have to be
territorial.
Yeah, and for breeding.
And my other question would be, if you think we had a traditional winter, the winter of, you know, 80 came in, or 83 came back, do you think that the urban deer herd would take care of itself? Because now you're going to have does fawning, fawns not being able to make it through the winter, does weak from the fawning process. You know what I mean? They're just not healthy enough to survive, where you get this herd of 90 or 120 that all of a sudden are 60, and you got carcasses laying around the town.
You know, there could be a setback, but I don't think, you know, we always say that you know, you can have a problem with two bears or two bighorn sheep or two deer, and it's less than 200, but you'll still have the deer that are imprinted in the urban areas, but it would reduce their densities and reduce the number of homeowners frustrated. But I don't think we're going to see that.
I don't see it.
Wait. Okay. Time out. I'm going back to item 14, which is future agenda items. I'm closing that one, and I'm now opening public comment. Go ahead.
No, my public comment is just to make people aware of the legislative luncheon that will be held on March the 19th at 11:30, room 3100, legislative building. There'll be a good number of NGOs, hopefully a much bigger number of legislators. We've got 24 freshman legislators. Hopefully, you know, we're sending invitations out to every legislator. And the food's going to be really cool this year. It's going to be put together. The caterer's going to be that one up in Reno that did the fish preparation and game preparation.
Yeah.
Outfit caterers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was there Saturday and talked to their owner about doing this thing, and it's going to be a little bit more expensive. We're also going to have elk. We're going to have elk on the menu in addition to chicken. I'm trying to have elk sliders being prepared. So that a lot of people who turn their nose up at game have an opportunity to taste it and learn a little bit about it. So it should be a good time. I'm inviting the advisory boards, I'm inviting the NGOs. You know.
Cool. Thank you.
One more little public comment to go over that anecdotal story. So.
Okay.
Walking northbound on Carson Street by north of Winnie Lane, and this is about 10, 12 years ago, at first light, there was a buck mule deer eating in a dumpster behind a Taco Bell. And I got him out of there when I walked by, and he ran across the street, got tagged by a car on the rear end, and crawled over by the PERS building, and I left him alone. I didn't think he was that bad. I left him alone. Went back there 2 hours later, and he was gone. But I didn't have a camera phone in those days, but I would have liked to have gotten a picture of him coming out of that dumpster because he was making a lot of racket.
He was fully inside.
He was fully inside the dumpster.
Another public comment.
I have a public question. I'm no longer your recorder. I'm a
okay.
What? What do you do when coyotes are in your front yard or behind your fence and, you know, they're kind of checking out your dogs? Do you have a number to call?
Firecrackers.
I have a bullhorn.
No, you know.
I would like to hurt them.
Someone really immediately that you can, that would respond.
Okay.
Well, those air blasters might scare them.
I have a bullhorn. Also, the other comment I had was the whole deer thing about the historical district comes up a lot in the Historic Resources Commission. And a lot of it comes up because most of the residents there are against taking down a lot of the fruit trees. Because they liked watching the deer come and eat it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say earlier when we were having this discussion, you know, that it's not like we're feeding them. It's that the food is here. And those fruit trees, yeah. Yeah. So that's a good point.
So I'm no longer
public. Thanks. Now you're putting on your earphones again?
She didn't want to hear herself.
Mr. Volz.
It is an issue of food sources, and certainly for any urbanites who plant things such as roses and other things that deer like, they really need to rethink what they have in their yards as an attractant. That's a big part of it. But The other dimension is you have to look at Lake Tahoe and the bear situation, and one of the problems that they're having is that they have an attractive nuisance, and that is they have not taken a comprehensive approach in the basin to managing their trash. So the bears come down out of the wilderness for the free food. You talk about welfare deer on the west side. Well, they have a much bigger problem up there. The Forest Service at their campsites has taken the action of installing bear-proof containers. But at this point, the jurisdictions within the lakes basin have not done anything about that, and it's created a huge number of ongoing calls to NDAO to deal with the situation, which causes a lot of public consternation, and it's the same way here in Carson City when we're talking about the deer. So if you're talking about education of the public, that's really the first thing to do, is to encourage the public not only not to feed them, but more importantly, not to plant stuff that's going to be attractive to them. And if they have it in their yards, to pull it and put something else in. And that's really one of the most important things you can do if you want to minimize the human bear, human deer problems that Carson City is having, to the extent that some people think that they're a problem anyway. Not everybody, as you've mentioned and suggested, agrees with that.
Exactly. I think it's going to be a difficult...
That's an uphill fight. You know, my son's a law enforcement officer in Lyon County, and the people have set up feeding stations for the horses along Highway 50. And the horses start to come there, and that's how the cops know that they're going to be a food drop. Mm-hmm. And the cops go sit there, and the people who are enabling the animals just move to the next one, mm-hmm, and drop their food. And then move to the next one and drop their food. So I'm saying that it's not insurmountable, but it's an uphill battle. Education would certainly, mm-hmm, be. These law enforcement officers are stopping these people and threaten them with citation, and they still do it.
But one of the solutions for Carson City could be something called diversionary feeding, which has also been proposed for the bears, but there hasn't really been the, shall we say, political or economic will to do anything about that, to draw them away on a regular, sustained basis from the urban areas.
And if we get out of the drought, they might not be hanging around town.
Well, that's true, but we could put something up Kings Canyon, Coombs Canyon, what have you, Hobart Lake, and in order to take those deer up there looking for food and water on a regular basis, and that might be one of the solutions that Carson City should be looking at if they're really concerned about the issue.
They tried that in Jackson Hole. They're regretting it. Overwhelming right now.
Right. Well, they've done very well in Cranbrook, B.C. with it, though, and some other communities. So I don't know that one community's experience necessarily tells the whole story.
And I can't wait for this whole thing to unfold. There's so many things that can come into it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any other public comment? Seeing none. I will take a motion on adjournment.
I'll make a motion to adjourn the meeting.
Second that.
A little faster, please. any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anybody want a Gundog magazine? I get
that. Oh, I do have both of those. I have those. Yeah, those are great.
Done? I get them.
I like the one on, the one on old timers is really good. I got a 12-year-old, and they got some great stories about old dogs and old hunters.
Usually
doesn't
matter.
Yes,
I've got really some things.
Absolutely. I've been away for a couple hours at a time now.
Oh, I was going to say,